Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use jobs. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Carpcast. How's it going, Mark?
It's going up and down, if I'm honest, at the minute.
Up and down?
Yeah. Although my bobbins are staying still. I'm on a 7-night blank run and the carp gods have forsaken me.
The carp gods are do not giveth.
No, they are taking. This week I cracked off a spom in sacrifice to them. I broke another. Got a welly full of ice cold water, and didn't even catch a bream.
Do you have a ritual when you get to the lake? You know, some people they flick money in the water, don't they? Have you ever seen people do that?
I'm from Yorkshire. That's not happening.
Just toss a bit of silver into the lake, dive in, and get it back again.
Yeah, I might go. A coin, drill a hole in it, keep it on a bit of line so I can toss it in and pull it back out for next time.
That's how they all used to scam the fruit machines in Blackpool years ago. They had a coin and they'd drill it with cotton or something, put it in the slot and pull it back out just so it registers.
Worth a try.
Yeah, you can try that for the lake. Yeah, it's... I've never done anything like that. I suppose when I've been fishing serious lakes, you know, when every session means something, you're either learning or you're one step closer to catching, you know, the real sort of low stock lakes where it's all a puzzle to work out. You're just not expecting to catch more than a couple of bites a year. I guess I have kind of fallen into like rituals, maybe the way to describe it, but I've never had something, you know, like take a spirit to, you know, like some people, when they open a bottle of spirits or something or an alcoholic drink, they pour a bit out, like, as I've seen people do it in a mountain. That it's not, I mean, I've had a bar and it's not great when you know, your nice clean floor, I see somebody order a drink and then pour out of it on the deck. It's not good. Again, that probably never happens in Yorkshire.
No, nobody spills a pint in Yorkshire. I've seen people literally fall over drunk, head first down in the gutter, yet the arm still remains up holding a pint. The most memorable one was an old friend of mine called Pickles. This is the Monsters of Rock Festival, 95 or 96, when we were young and stupid. Mm. He literally fell headfirst into the ditch. All you could see was 2 feet sticking up and an arm holding his pint. His head was almost fully submerged in silt and mud and slime at the bottom of the ditch, but his pint was fine.
That was my first ever concert, first ever festival, Monsters of Rock at Donington, 1988 it was. Long hair, yeah. Down my back. Guns N' Roses, first ever UK appearance. Iron Maiden headlined. Kiss were on. David Lee Roth with Steve Vai, my favourite guitarist at the time. Obviously, I had to get away from rock music when my hair fell out. But I still appreciate it. I have a Spotify mix, actually. I don't know if anyone's into Spotify on here. We should do it. Should probably do it in the Worth a Look section. So there's no reason why we can't do a Worth a Look now.
Worth a Look.
But if you're not onto Spotify, I guess most people are. But I do speak to people fairly regularly that you know, are aware it exists, but don't really know what it is. But it's fantastic if you're into music, any style of music. It's basically free. You do get annoying adverts, much like our show now. But you get adverts, but it's free, and it's literally every song ever made in all genres, and brilliant playlists. You can pay like a tenner a month to not have adverts, but most people just use the free version on your phone or on your computer. But the beauty of it is you can follow people's playlists. So we're talking about rock. I made a playlist called I Once Played the Guitar. It's got all my kind of big tunes that I was into from like the 80s and 90s sort of rock era. But you could just, it links in with Facebook, so if you have a Spotify account, or just make one with your Facebook account, and if you're friends with me on Facebook, you'll see that I'm in your friends list, and you can follow like any playlist I make, or I can follow a playlist you make, or Spotify have millions of playlists, literally millions, for any mood you can think of. Like, they've got ones for, you know, heartbroken, like your missus has dumped you and you can go and cry yourself to sleep,
or party.
Yeah, or party. They've got they've got millions of party playlists, but like if there's a party playlist, it'll be in like 100 subgenres, disco or funk or whatever. There's just millions. Like their playlists are what really make them. So those are like concentration ones for studying, like mood, all different mood ones for depending on what type of mood you're in. But it's great, and obviously you can follow us. So it sounds like you haven't got one, Mark. You haven't chipped in yet, but you should make one. And people can
I've
then
got the app. But I've never really never used it.
Most people are like that. I had it myself for 2 or 3 years. Same thing. Just had it on my phone and never got into it. But it's so simple to get into. Just make an account with your Facebook and anyone else that's got a Spotify account, which you'll probably find is most of your friends. But obviously you can follow our one, so you can listen to my I Once Played the Guitar mix. I'm pretty sure I've shared it as public. But obviously, if I change that playlist, it changes in your feed as well. So if I add tunes to it or take them away or whatever. Or you can just snaffle songs off it and put them into your own playlist. So any song you see on anyone's playlist, if you just right-click on these little dots at the side of the song, you can add it to one of your own playlists. So you don't even need... all the famous bands have got playlists on there, so you can like listen to what they listen to, if you know what I mean, like your favourite drummer or guitarist or singer or whatever. You can just follow them and you can just see what they're listening to. It might put you onto some new music, or it's brilliant, like really, really good. And I couldn't believe that I hadn't got into it. Everyone I've put onto it in the last few months is like, wow, how do I not know about this? Your favourite record label, like Reedy's into D&B, and all his favourite labels into the hospital label, who run events called Hospitality. It's pretty sick, sort of D&B fest. But like that, you know, they're putting playlists up every day on there. He's like, wow, I never knew about this. Like, my favourite thing is, like, they do all the work for you, you just listen to their playlist every day. He's got it on all day while he's working in the office. But Spotify, worth a look. Get on it and follow us, and I'm sure you might be making some playlists now, Mark.
Maybe, I think maybe about 3 people would like them.
But, death metal.
Do you know what music I'm actually listening to at the minute?
Go on.
Is a variation of either Slayer, Pantera, Johnny Cash, some strange Leonard Cohen songs, and Nick Cave.
Some pretty eclectic playlists then, if you make one.
And I'll just say the last one, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. If you don't like them, you don't like music. Brilliant.
I will make a playlist. I'll have a listen. This is what I'm saying. Nick Cave's probably got a Spotify account, and you can probably listen. I'm not joking. You can probably listen to what he listens to. So,
yeah. I think he could be quite strange himself. Do you know he did a cover of with Shane McGowan of the Pogues?
Yeah,
What a Wonderful World, and made it sound the most depressing suicidal song you've ever heard.
Wow. Well, yeah, I like the Pogues occasionally. So yeah, we should be paid by Spotify for this. This little promotion. If they wish to advertise on us, then you can join us, just like DNA. DNA, see what I did there?
Yeah, you're getting good at these segues now. I'm liking this.
DNABaits.com, fantastic company. Lots of people I know use their baits extremely successfully. They are a sponsor of the Carpcast, www.dnabaits.com. They're doing an autumn winter boilie package at the minute. It's 20 kilos of any of their boilie range delivered free to your door. It's £120. You can get a discount on anything you buy off their website by using the discount code when you check out, CARPCAST5. Which everyone seems to be using now, that code. So just remember that, CARPCAST5, if you buy anything off any of our sponsors' sites. You will be entitled to, for DNA, it's a 5% discount. There is also still up there the Carpcast offer that that they did for us, which are the Cured Hook Baits Evo kit. It's got the GLM powder, like a really high quality GLM powder. I think it's £20 again, delivered post free. It does support us, and they've been really popular apparently, and we've had a few catch reports in of people like our followers catching on it, so it's great. Obviously we spoke to Roger last week, who was on Sourcey in France, and he finished up with tons of fish. I think he finished up with 350s and 540s, smallest being 43, something like that, like a 5-6 day session. Yeah, he had it right off. He had a really good session. So yeah, that's that Evo hook bait kit and GLM powder, that's £20 delivered. But you buy anything off their website and get a 5% discount on www.dnabaits.com. And a new advertiser and sponsor, supporter of the show, I know they're big fans of the show, is Gifts for Anglers. Now, with Christmas approaching, all the it's that time of year where, you know, you get books in your Christmas stocking and all sorts of useful stuff. Gifts for Anglers is a company that stock thousands of fishing books, DVDs, clothing, and loads more. They cover everything like carp fishing, coarse fishing, game and sea fishing, and there's something for all anglers.
Yeah, in their stock is the latest carp fishing books, DVDs, as well as some very popular monkey climber clothing, 40 sunglasses, fat fish clothing, and hundreds of gift ideas such as key rings, mugs, socks, carp shaped pillows.
I want one of them.
I want two.
We'll have to blag us some free gear. Them 40s glasses are ace as well.
Yeah, I've got a pair.
The fat fish clothing's all good, and the monkey climber clothing, I see them at the show. So in fact we have all those companies at the Northern Angling Show. You can basically get any gift for anybody for Christmas presents or any sort of present, or if you just need a bit of new reading material, they've got thousands and thousands of books. I think they've even got some of my knowledge DVDs, unless they sold them out, but they definitely used to have some. They bought a couple of loads off me when I first released them years ago. So basically anything gifty for us carpers, course anglers, anybody. And again, you can get 5% discount off all purchases made at www.giftsforanglers.co.uk and enter CARPCAST5 at the checkout. It doesn't include subscriptions, that deal, if you want a subscription to any of the mags and stuff that they do. But that's the only thing it doesn't include. But any of the gifts, books, clothing, everything else, CARPCAST5 at the checkout. It's up till end of January, I think that lasts for. www.gifts, it's the number 4, anglers.co.uk. Giftsforanglers.co.uk. And I know they've got Crowy's book, which is new. We had Crowy on the podcast. A fan of the show and fantastic angler who's been on an absolute heater this year, hasn't he?
He's going to have to write another book with all the fish he's caught this year alone.
Yeah, I don't know when he actually finished his book. I know it's just out now. You can get it on there as well. I think it's $34.99 plus postage for like a hardback copy. And there's leather ones as well. I think the leather ones are £175 and you get a free hardback version as well, so you don't mash up your leather one. £175. But I think we need to get Crowy back on to talk about his book, but I know we've got one on our way to us in the post, so I think I want to read it first and do a proper review.
Yes, looking at 40 chapters, 500 plus full colour pages. You're going to know when the postman's coming down your path with that, because he'll be limping and struggling because that's got to weigh a ton.
Yeah, some fantastic photography and stuff in there. So all the lakes he's fished over the years, you know, a lot of the Yorkshire lakes. I know he's very passionate about sort of fishing in Yorkshire. He's, you know, he had them all out of Tylery, Moatway Pond, Waldview, up sort of Lincolnshire way, Selby Three Lakes. He caught Black Eye, didn't he? Nostell Priory, big one. He's had some cracking fish, and even more this year, so I'm really looking forward to reading that, and we'll do a review on it once we've both read it.
Yeah, that's probably going to be through the next CARPCAST, because, you know, once I don't read that many books, but once I get stuck in, that's it, I can't put it down.
Yeah, it's just poker books I've been reading recently. I've been getting pretty deep on the study, and I'm on to going past poker and learning game theory now, which is to be unexploitable while playing poker. So yeah, that's all I had my head in. I had I bought two books, as you'll see on our Amazon link this week. We'll probably get about 20p back for it, but yeah, I bought a couple of books through our link, and that's all I do now. I haven't read books for ages, but if you do read books or any other carpy gifts, then giftsforanglers.co.uk and use CARPCAST5 at the checkout for a discount, and it supports us, which is really, really good.
Very, very good.
On the net, have you seen anything on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
I've seen a great big fat comment.
Yeah, I saw that one as well. It's the first time I've seen a really big really big fish out of Shanty Cove for quite a few years.
Yeah, it seems to have, I don't know, you know, disappeared a bit. I don't know if the lads are keeping it quiet on there, but that was shared on the Cat World Facebook page, and I did a double take. It's like, wow, that is, you know, the fish of 44 kilos, which is around 96 pounds, they don't grow on trees, especially commons, and, you know, I admittedly don't know masses about the place, but I certainly didn't know of anything approaching that size in there.
I remember Alan Taylor and Kevin Maddox did a video on there years ago in the mud.
Yeah, I think it's very you know, similar to the Orient in that respect, for the mud and the old tree stumps and snags in there, and the pretty traumatic fishing, basically.
It's pretty much across the road. They're very close to each other. That little auto route des Anglais that comes straight out of the ferry port, and you basically follow it right down into France. You pass the Forest de Orient on your left, and then Shantico is on the right. It's a queue, isn't it, Shantico? Which if you think of Coco Van, which is spelled the same, K-O-Q, is it not Shanticock?
Well, Shanty.
We always called it Shanticock when I was a kid, but I'm guessing Husey or Crowy will put us straight on that one, being French adventurers for a long, long time.
But yeah, Lac du Dare. That's still in it. Lac du Dare.
Lac du Dare.
Yeah, or du Dare Chanticock, I've got written in front of me. I'm just looking at the pictures of that thing now, and it is a monster.
Yeah, that... Did they not lose a load of fish a few years ago? They've had a fish killer. I know the English were accused of robbing loads of them.
I can't see why.
Quite a few years ago. In fact, did they not even ban English anglers at one point? I'm not talking in the massive past, like in the last 5-6 years. I heard that English anglers weren't welcome on there. Somebody who I believe... I mean, I'm repeating stuff here. I have zero evidence for, which has never stopped us before on this show. So
never let the truth get in the way of a good gossip.
No, but I'm sure somebody well known, or at least known, was caught red-handed with some sort of pickup and a tank in the back and a load of fish leaving the lake, and I'm sure English anglers got banned after that. Now, I'm talking probably a third or fourth hand story that I heard at the time, but whoever told it me, it seemed believable at the time, and I'm sure they weren't really welcoming English anglers after that. And apparently this person had been fishing it for pretty regular for a while, and you know, it appeared if that's what was going on, then it was happening a lot. But I mean, it used to have a massive stock of extremely large fish, didn't it? You know, above average size fish.
Yeah, quite distinctive as well. They look like, well, horses.
They look like all the fish in quite a few lakes I've seen in the UK in the early 90s.
mention no names, obviously. It's all alleged.
Yeah, I'm not gonna mention, but you don't see many fish of that shape. You know the shape we're talking about. I mean, there's a lot of foreign lakes are quite prominent now, and the fish aren't that shape. The Shantico fish were extremely recognisable.
Big humpbacks, long, slopy heads, and like real big barbels. I remember seeing a lot of them as well.
Exactly, yeah, and they did turn up in a few lakes, you know, and we know a lot more now about carp and strains and stuff, and you know, it's not, you don't see many many fish like that in the UK.
The Royale strain, I believe it is.
The what strain?
The Royale strain, I believe that one is.
That's right, yeah. We didn't really ask. We've got Simon Scott in part two in this show, which is the juicy part, really. It's the stuff that kind of blew my mind chatting to him. We had part one in the last show. Go and check it out if you haven't listened. But we also had the World Championship edition with Rob Hughes, so we couldn't fit all of Simon Scott's part in, so we got a good hour of him today. And didn't really ask him about strains, which is something we can ask him. There were so many questions that I didn't get to ask him, and we went on nearly 2 hours, so he's definitely going to come back for another one, and we'll get a load of listeners' questions and stuff as well. Yeah, I'm interested really in the different strains around Europe. Obviously, the Dinks is one of my favourite ones. The sort of big, large plates, and we spoke about them before with the Elstow 2 twin and Epilepse.
Yeah, and Scaly and the old Baston Fen fish as well. They were that similar sort, and I'm quite biased because I was just obsessed with catching that twin.
Yeah,
there's an interesting story behind the origins of that one and a few of his friends as well. They were, as far as I know, they were actually purchased by anglers as low singles from a garden centre up the road and stocked.
I did hear that, yeah. Sure, we might have mentioned it once before on one of the early shows, but yeah, I remember we me or you, one of us printed something similar to that back in the day when we used to write articles for magazines, around the time we were fishing Elstow 1, and we were kind of vilified. People wanted to kill us because we were kind of bubbling people up for illegal stocking of fish, which...
Yeah, that went on so long ago, though.
Yeah, of course it did, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's not the lake owner's fault, and it's not, you know, there's no... I couldn't even say the names of the anglers, I'm sure you know, but of the anglers that did it, and it's not really... grassing a lake up for stocking illegal fish, is it? Let's be honest.
It's totally different nowadays, but there's one lake in Doncaster, I mean, you can't even fish there anymore, Thorpe Marsh Power Station Pond, and most of the big fish in there were named after the lake they were nicked from.
Exactly. It used to go on a lot back in the day. You know, we're a bit more wiser now as to moving fish about, and anglers and lake owners alike don't really want to take the risk anymore of losing. If you've got a decent existing stock, nobody wants to take the risk of losing it by dropping a few other fish in. So I don't think it's much of a problem these days when we're aware. You know, I'm not saying fish don't get moved between counties, you know, there's nature reserves and fish get put from one lake into another, but they're generally on the same water table anyway. You know, they've gotten the same birds and stuff landing, transferring the bacterias and any stuff. So I mean, it's not like yes, it's illegal and you shouldn't ever move fish without a section 30, but you know, when stuff gets moved from a reserve to the lake you can fish next door, I mean, it's not going to harm the ecosystem too much, because anything that they're carrying is probably in the lake next door anyway, because they're all in the same water table, and you know, there's bird life and stuff transferring, floods transfer fish as well. So
yeah, I believe the I could be wrong again, it's something to ask Simon Scott if we get him on again. I believe the legal situation is that you have to be, you know, literally joined, which is why when we were fishing down Cambridgeshire, one complex of lakes, you know, the owner actually joined them all up with pipes. So it's basically one water course all joined, and it could legally move fish between each one.
Yeah, makes total sense. Talking of Cambridgeshire, something else I saw on the net today, and I don't actually have it in front of me, so I've got no names, but I did see another prosecution today on Facebook from a guy fishing a nature reserve in Godmanchester, which an area we know very well, Cambridgeshire. He's been prosecuted. He didn't have rod license either, and he's been fined. He got a fine for the rod license and a fine for the poaching. It does say, and we mentioned the Angling Trust last week, but I am seeing a lot more cases of illegal fishing being enforced, which, you know, I guess is a good thing. You can't say, I want to go and poach nature reserves, and then, like, have a go at the Eastern Europeans for poaching rivers. You know, you like can't have it both ways. Either they're both wrong or none of them are wrong. You know, to protect the fishing stock in the UK, then obviously we want it all to be wrong. Illegal fishing is illegal fishing. And if you do go guesting, as it were, you are taking the risk of being arrested and whatever fines the courts throw at you. So we all know that. But it's to be applauded, I think. You know, the Angling Trust have to be behind all these recent prosecutions. So it's a good thing, I think. But yeah, it's we mentioned a story last week, didn't we? And well, a couple of stories, and it's still going on. I wish I had the details in front of me, actually. But it was a nature reserve in Godmanchester anyway. The guy had cut he cut into kind of a bush, I think, and had a brolly and bivvy and stuff in there. The fine wasn't huge. I mean, I think the biggest fine was was for the no rod licence, which is daft. I mean, if you're fishing a nature reserve, then you ought to at least have that. You just get done for the trespassing or the illegal taking of fish. Not that I could be done for the illegal taking of fish, because I'm pretty sure you have to catch one to be done for that.
What about intent to illegally catch fish? Is that a crime?
Well, intent to do anything that's illegal is illegal, so I'm guessing it probably is. Something else on the net, actually, was something that went on today on our page.
It's on the net. It must be true.
I posted a picture up of a Throwback Thursday old school setup from Horseshoe. I think it was about 87 or 88 that picture was took. It looks like it was on the winter bank of my very flashy, I think it was the original Fox Pod, like folding legs, monkey climbers, original bait runners, which were the lick at the time, and two rods hand built by Foster's of Birmingham. They used to do the Northwestern carbon Kevlars at the time, through action. They were 2.25 pound Tesco through action. They bent right to the but I've still got one left, actually. I had three in the end. I've got one left that I use as a floater rod. It's had the tip broke off a couple of times, so it's a little bit shorter than it probably started off life as, but it's a brilliant floater rod. It's really nice, really soft. But one of the chaps who made a comment underneath it, who used to fish Horseshoe at that time, is a guy called Baz Griffiths, who's an old school angler from Birmingham area. And it just reminded me of how nice some people are in fishing. And, you know, special mention to Baz. I didn't know he listened to the show, but he must do, because he posted on our page. And I fished a lake called Lower Tamar in the 80s. It was in Easter, because in our conventional close season, you could go to Devon and Cornwall and fish the reservoirs there, which all had decent carp in. And one, you could use three rods, which was heaven, because the rest of the country was two. And two, you could fish in the close season, where it was just something to do with their laws. And I was fishing Lower Tamar. It was about the second or third time I'd ever fished there. We used to go down there as a holiday with the family, who used to stay near Bude up the road. Leave me at the fishing lake, and they used to, my mum and dad used to, my sister would go horse riding, they'd bring me food down every day, and I'd fish on the lake for a week. And this one time, Baz came and fished just a couple of pegs up on the same bank or whatever, and I'd done a couple of sessions on there already, and I'd found out about this like sunken riverbed that ran parallel to the bank. I forget how far out it was now, like 50 yards out or something, and somebody had, one of the locals the year before, had put me onto fishing in this riverbed. Anyway, I was hauling off it, and Baz was taking the pictures while blanking, if I remember rightly. He's the first one who taught me actually about the importance of a photograph. I mean, I'd take a picture of a fish on the floor or whatever, and he's like, no, I'll get a nice bush behind you, you know, something colourful. And I've still got the pictures to this day. I might dig them out and post them up if I can find them, but I've definitely got the pictures that he took. And he was a thoroughly nice chap. Was working with the Carp Society at the time. We spoke about the Carp Society last week, and this is one of the other reasons why I'm so bitter about kind of the way the Carp Society has gone, because things like this used to happen. They used to have a junior fishing on Horseshoe. I didn't live a million miles from Birmingham. I lived the other side of Stratford-upon-Avon, which is not that far, from about 40-minute drive from Birmingham. And Baz told me about this junior fishing on Horseshoe and offered to come and pick me up from my house and take me to this thing. And I never forget that, you know, some fantastic fishing, people in fishing, and he's one of them, or certainly was. I'm pretty sure he still will be. So hello to Baz if you're listening, and yeah, thank you very much for that, and I hope you're doing well. Do you remember seeing him on the front pages of Carp Talk a few years back? He had 250s out of Frampton. Do you remember? I remember reading quite a bit about it. I remember being pleased at the time, thinking that was great. Frampton's a lake you don't hear a great deal about. Mike Wilmot's book and that, basically, and Baz's captures. I think it was 250s or 49 or 50. I'm sure he had a brace of 50s, though. My memory serves me correct. They were extremely big, anyway. If they weren't 50, they were 48, 49 plus.
That does ring a bell, but I do remember reading about Baz Griffiths in the El Cartwells with regards to Horseshoe.
Yeah. Yeah, he was he was a prominent figure, back in the day then. So it was good. It was nice for him to meet, a young, keen lad, as I was at the time. And then offered, come pick me up, go 40 minutes out of his way to pick me up and then and take me to Horseshoe. So it's fantastic. And they're the sort of things the Carp Society used to do for the young'uns back in the day. You know, they had a lot of stuff that encouraged the younger members. I was a younger member that, was heavily into carp fishing and wanted to be a part of something. And it's such a shame the way it's gone, I think. But anyway, yeah, props to Baz anyway for... being a fantastic guy, and I hope you're still out there catching, mate.
Oh, he created a monster in you, did he?
He did. I mean, there was a few things that the passion of carp fishing was something that was very big for me from an early age. You know, I just wanted to do it over everything else. And it stays with you. I've not been quite as keen this year, but obviously we're still involved in the industry. We've still got the angling show, and we do this podcast every week now, and it does fire me up every time we talk about it. But as far as getting out on the bank, I actually have a week's fishing booked in now in the middle of November. I'm going to go and meet a couple of people for interviews on the bank. I'm going to do a Carp TV piece as well while we're there. Going to meet Joe Morgan, going to meet Bev Clifford, and hopefully catch a few fish. Not 100% sure where we're going to go yet, but we shall be out on the bank, and I'm going to see if I can remember how to tie a rig.
You want me to send some over in the post?
Get some ready made from somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, some of the ready made rigs aren't that bad nowadays. It's not just something thrown together. And on the match side in the shop, a lot of the serious men, they can't be bothered to tie rigs now. The rigs that they can buy ready tied are that good, it just saves them time and they use them.
We were invited on a French holiday actually earlier. Spoke to a guy we both know, Christophe, of Elstow fame. He's got a chapter in Martin Clark's first book, actually. If you don't know who Christoph is, he's an underground big fish carper, been fishing a lot of years, hell of a lot of years. He is actually French, hence the name Christoph, although he doesn't sound French, he sounds southern. Known him for a long, long time. He owns a lake in France, actually, and is another Carpcast sponsor. Spoke to him today. He owns a fantastic lake. Roger went and fished it with his family the other year. It's a great place for a holiday for your family. And he's invited us to with our... Did you see his video at the last Northern Angling Show?
About 30 times.
Yeah, he was on our stand,
yeah,
wasn't
we
he?
Were sharing the little corner store, yeah. And it was a nice video. It was not just a nice lake, nice fish, but a nice amenities there.
The facilities are amazing. There's a lodge on site, bedrooms and cooking gear. It's really geared towards families, or families and friends. It's a runs water. It's got a stock of 400 plus carp, loads of fish between 20 up to 47 pound. I think Roger had all the 40s when he went. He didn't even fish at nights. I think the action was so much. Like, he was only fishing, times that he didn't want to sleep, if you know what I mean. It's like four and a half acres, You get a house that's exclusively to yourselves. It's fully furnished, sleeps 10 people. It's open all year round. There's a special discounted price of £850 instead of £1,250, which is based on five anglers. It's £170 each. You can drive and survive, or you can rent tackle from him over there and fly to Limoges Airport. It's like 45 minutes away from the lake, I think. So yeah, he can supply all the equipment for you. You can just fly out there with your family, or you can drive and survive it. It's got a promo video, actually, on YouTube. It's Saint Armand Leisure. Armand is spelled A-M-A-N-D. Saint Armand Leisure. We'll post the link below our Facebook page, actually, and we'll post it in the show notes on iTunes and stuff. But yeah, he's another sponsor of the Carpcast, and he said, I mean, you can go out there, he'll give us a week out there. We can take the women, get a nice warm holiday and go and catch loads of fish to 47. But I know the lake looks beautiful. I saw that video at our show last year. We'll put the YouTube link up for the video so people can watch it. If you want to speak to anybody about the venue, you can contact Lee on 07854 857 374, or there's Chris as well. You speak to Chris on 07428 183 018 for any info about the lake. But it's saintarmandleisure.com, S-T-A-M-A-N-D leisure.com, www.saintarmandleisure.com. And we shall be out there next year, but it's a fantastic place. It's absolutely stunning. It's beautiful. It's a runs water. It's full of fish. You've got a house there that sleeps up to 10. And it's pretty cheap. He's doing a discount of £850 instead of the normal £1,250. And they're taking bookings now for next year. So get on that. And again, thank you for supporting us and sponsoring the Carpcast. Still selling loads of knowledge videos as well. Find them on eBay. I'm not going to go into detail because I hammer on about the knowledge every week, but I'm selling loads of them. So it's really good news, and does help us keep this weekly, which people seem to like now. So that's cool.
Yeah, people have been asking us just to go weekly for a while, and we're here. We've done it. We've just got to.
We are. We're going to annoy you with a couple of adverts. One thing we will promise with the adverts is we'll never have more than five. I don't think anybody wants to listen to 20 minutes of adverts. You know, and we'll try and make the adverts as entertaining as we can, so you don't just flick through them. But there won't ever be any more than five adverts. If we have more than five people wanting to advertise, we just have to put the price up because we don't want to ruin the content.
No. Is there any more ads, or are we still on the net?
Only the normal one, the Northern Angling Show, northernanglingshow.co.uk. We won't go into detail, but you can buy your tickets now. There's loads of VIP packs on there, and we'll go into more detail when we've got a couple of big announcements coming up with the people that are on stage and the exhibitor lineups. And the main thing we need to announce is the Carpcast stand on there. We're going to be doing Carpcast Live.
So
we are, yeah. I've not told you this yet.
We're going to be live.
We're going to do Carpcast Live, as we call it. It might not actually be broadcast live, but we'll certainly be recording it to play on future shows. But we're going to have a Carpcast stand on there. You'll be able to buy all our merchandise we haven't made yet. Well, you will be able to buy it, and we're going to be interviewing all the people that are at the show, all the sort of famous, well-known anglers attending via different companies. And we're basically going to have a couple of sofas, a little PA set up, and we're just going to sit there interviewing people all day on the Saturday and Sunday. It's the 21st of February, that weekend, 2016. And Carpcast Live will be there, and hopefully with loads of great content to be putting out after the show.
I'll make a prediction for that.
Go on.
I will drink a record amount of coffee.
Yeah, because I'm guessing it's going to be you doing most of the interviewing.
Yeah, you'll be running around like the headless chicken you usually are at your do's.
Yeah, well, it's a bit easier now. We'll be on show 4 this year, so...
You know what to expect.
Yeah, we're pretty organised. I'm actually hosting the main stage on the Tuesday. The Sunday. So yeah, I guess you'll be doing a lot of the Carpcast interviews then. But yeah, we'll have a wealth of fishing names on there. So if you want to get tickets for Northern Angling Show, if you want to see the first ever Carpcast live, then get yourself to northernanglingshow.co.uk and purchase one of the VIP packs or just a normal ticket for the Saturday or Sunday and come and say hello to us. Come and buy us a drink. We could get slaughtered.
That'll take 2 pints with me.
Yeah, me too. I don't drink too much anymore.
Old age, but you know. Well, there's another thing on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
You have to bear with me on this one. It does eventually get round to fishing. But two things. Joe Rogan's latest podcast with a Dutch guy called the Iceman, or Wim Hof.
I listened to it all after you mentioned it yesterday. Yeah. And there's a video as well.
The other one. It's Vice News did a documentary which is to be found on YouTube. Now, this fella, Wim Hof, is a Dutchman, lives in his houseboat, and the cold is his god. He's got this mad breathing thing, which he actually gets Joe Rogan to do on his podcast, which that's also on YouTube. And his theory is he just supercharges his body with oxygen and he can withstand the cold and all these other feats. And he's not some, you know, crackpot. He has actually been scientifically tested. He has climbed Everest in his shorts.
Yeah, I saw that. Nothing but shorts. barefooted as well, wasn't he?
No, I think he was barefooted on Kilimanjaro. He had to wear boots on Everest. It was too slippy.
The guy is an amazing feat. He's not a young guy either.
He's 56.
Yeah, he swam under the ice. Like, was it like a meter thick ice?
Yeah,
he swam under. He went for 60 metres and he went too far. He missed the hole to come back out of, and he missed it because his retinas froze and he couldn't see. That's how cold it was. His retina froze. Just think about that. He charges his body up with a breathing technique. You can hear it on the last Joe Rogan podcast. But the guy is amazing.
Yeah,
but anyone can do it. They reckon that he's responsible for all the breakthroughs in the human body that we're learning at the minute.
The way he says he's like connects you with your reptilian brain, you know, the part of the brain that can control your own immune system and, you know, all these mad stuff. So this is where it gets round to fishing. I arrived at my syndicate, the old big pit, this week. I'm going to fish a swim that's probably a good 200 metres walk through the barra, and I'll hold my hands up, I'm not the fittest of people out there. So I think I'm certainly not the fattest.
I'm working on it.
I'm a long, lean specimen. But I think I'm not looking forward to this push with a barra. So I think to myself, I'll have a go at this Wim Hof breathing techniques that he showed Joe Rogan. I'll see if it works. So after 5 of his deep breaths, I just burst out laughing at myself, thinking, what are you doing, you idiot? So I calmed down. I thought, I did it, all the way through again, 30 breaths, which, if you want to know exactly what he does, just watch the Joe Rogan thing. They'll explain it a lot better than I can. Did me 30 breaths, then held me breath and supercharged my body with oxygen and laughed at myself again, thinking how ridiculous it was. I picked my barra up and I made it all the way to the swim without stopping. Well, I stopped once when my food bag fell off. But I was like a trooper going to that swim through all the mud over the roots, bouncing my barra through, and I got there and I wasn't even out of breath.
Wow, yeah, when he does it to Joe Rogan, he holds his breath. First ever time, holds his breath for like 3.5 minutes, or is it longer?
I think it was 2.5 minutes it went for, but I actually did it later on that night and I held my breath for 2 minutes.
Wow.
I timed myself because I'm thinking, wow, this is actually working. Do you know what's weird as well? When I did it, before I set off my barra, I kind of felt, not lightheaded, but, slightly getting that way for about, 10 seconds. But my teeth were tingling.
Wow.
It's a really weird feeling. And, I'm probably a bit mad myself, but watch this stuff with Wim Hof. It really, really is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Check it out, because it's worth a look.
on the net and worth a look.
We've got a few things to do. We've got a couple of listeners' questions that we'll do later. And the car paint sheep. And I've got another worth a look as well, because I'm getting messages all the time now, people asking me for other podcasts, because it seems that we're turning the carp fishing community onto podcasts. It's definitely better than the radio, you know, because you can kind of listen to things you're actually interested in as opposed to things you have to listen to. So yeah, I've got another worth a look as well, but let's get Simon Scott back in and listen to what he's got to say.
Sorry to interrupt. Is there a perfect figure for the oxygen?
Well, oxygen, the water's ability to hold oxygen changes with temperature. So warm water holds less oxygen than cold water. But through the summer months, oxygen, I think we live in, and I've written about this in Carpology, but we live in an oxygen constant environment. Unless you happen to say, well, I'm going to go and climb up Everest today, most of us don't ever give oxygen a moment's thought. You know, we get up in the morning, there's oxygen in the air we're breathing. We have our day, there's oxygen in the air we're breathing. And when we go to bed, there should still be some oxygen in the air that we're breathing. But for a fish, that is a constantly changing environment for them. Oxygen levels do not stay the same in water through a 24-hour period. They go up and down, and in some conditions they can go up and down a very long way, and that has a massive impact on what the fish do, on the timing of their feeding, their position in the lake, their position in the water column, whether they're on the bottom or on the top. It dictates when they want to have food in their gut, because there's no point in eating a big meal and then not being able to digest it properly because there's no oxygen. So it has a massive, massive part to play on that side of their lives. It also has a big impact on pH. So oxygen, the diurnal rhythm which you get with algae blooms which affects the oxygen content of the water, also affects the pH. So the aquatic world that fish are living in is changing a lot through a 24-hour period, and a lot for a month or a year. So that has a massive impact on the fishes, on their feeding. And you see that colossally on, just absolutely on an enormous scale on the farm all the time. And so keeping an eye on that oxygen is important. So go to your original question, is there a perfect level for oxygen? Under 5 milligrams per litre of oxygen, which is a bit, the carp's ability to digest its food starts to deteriorate. So effectively, if there's less than 5 milligrams of oxygen in the water that the fish are in, their ability to actually utilise the nutrients that they've worked hard to take in is compromised. So anything under that, they're not going to be making the most of that food. So as a fish farmer, obviously I want to keep the oxygen levels above 5 milligrams per litre. Once it goes below that, the fish, you know, not going to be growing as well. In a fishery, you know, I go to fisheries and I put an oxygen meter in from time to time, and they'll have less oxygen than that, significantly less oxygen than that, and that may tie up with periods of the fish not feeding, for example. So if the oxygen's low, the fish are not going to feed.
What are the main causes of the oxygen being low? So is there certain weather conditions? Does low pressure reduce the oxygen, for instance?
It does to some extent. Without going too deeply into the science of it, but one of the most common factors is rotting plant material. So, for example, an algae bloom. And now when we talk about algae blooms, a lot of guys will think of green water, but it can be a bit more subtle than that. So it can be that sort of brown stain in the water can be algae. So there's lots and lots of different varieties, species of algae that all have different colours. So it's very common in water, fresh water in the UK, to have an algae bloom of some sort of or other going at the time. It's not necessarily always going to be pea green. So that sort of browny staining in the water is algae. Now those algae cells will be producing loads and loads of oxygen in the sunlight, and then at night they respire and they actually suck up oxygen and produce carbon dioxide. And as I mentioned earlier, that has an impact on the pH. And that also has, ties up with that, it also has an impact on the ammonia in the water as well and its toxicity to the fish, but that's aside. Now, an algae bloom that's healthy and doing very well will be producing masses of oxygen. So it's providing the fish with lots of oxygen to breathe. What happens when an algae bloom crashes, which is often associated with a big change in the weather, or a thunderstorm, or the algae bloom has actually run out of the nutrients that it needs, normally phosphates, to maintain itself, because remember, algae is a plant. If it hasn't got the material, the chemicals that it needs to keep running, it kills it. When that algae bloom crashes, often you'll get an oxygen crash as well. And so where you have billions of tiny algal cells photosynthesizing one day, once they crash, those billions of algae cells will be rotting and decaying. And as they decay, you often get these huge drop-offs in oxygen. So oxygen could go from being super saturated 1 week, very high in the sunshine in an afternoon, and the fish are loving it. 10 days later, the oxygen might be 1 milligram per liter. The fish aren't feeding. They're all up in the water feeding lethargic. And you know, we're not getting any bites, so it has a big, big part to play.
So I fished lakes, thinking of the Woolpack many years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with it in Cambridgeshire. You used to have a big 50 common that Jim caught, yep. Paddle it was called.
Yeah.
I remember late in the year, so we're going like November into December when it's cool, occasional frosty nights, the fish are on the surface every night, like first light in the morning, 6 a.m. you know, they were up on the surface, and it wasn't warm. It fished very slow at the time, and would you say that was an oxygen?
Difficult. I wouldn't want to put my neck on the line and say definitely, but I would imagine almost certainly yes. So you remember at that time of the year, although the water's cold, it can potentially hold lots of oxygen. There could also be a lot of rotting plant material in the water. So you imagine all the leaves that have fallen in the lake are rotting, and all the aquatic weed, all the algae is all rotting. All that rotting material, the microbes that are breaking up that rotting material, that are causing that rotting process to actually occur, they're all using up oxygen. And even in a fish stock pond, so a carp stock pond at the farm, most the carp normally only use about generalistic, but you're looking at maybe 10% of the available oxygen is used up by the fish population in a carp rearing pond. The rest is used up by the bacteria microbes that are making the pond tick over, the bacteria that are breaking up the fish waste and material in the water. So you know, there's lots of other bits and pieces using up the oxygen, and in that situation you described, the back end of the year, you think, oh, this is the time they're going to be at top weights now. But if there's loads of rotting plant material in the water and that's sucking up lots of oxygen, that can cause the algae, you know, the oxygen levels to crash very low, and of course the fish's response is to come right to the surface. And because the water's cold, oxygen is diffusing into it very readily. So because it's cold, it's almost sucking in the oxygen. So the surface layer is definitely the best place for the fish to be, because that's where the oxygen is coming in the quickest. So yeah, that makes good sense.
So does oxygen drop at night, every night anyway, just with the sunlight going?
Well, if you've got algae and submerged aquatic plants, it does, yes. Yeah. So we get what we call the diurnal rhythm. When the plants are photosynthesizing, they're producing oxygen in the presence of light, sunlight, and you get the oxygen being produced, and that causes the oxygen levels to rise, of course, right until the end of the day, and then they come down, and then the plants respire, and they're sucking up that oxygen and producing CO2, and then you get this sort of decreasing oxygen content, and that can run through until first light. And even if you've just got a bit of algae around the edges of the lake, you're going to see some sort of diurnal rhythm. Now, in a healthy environment, that won't be too severe, but in a really weedy, very eutrophic, very nutrient-rich lake, that can be quite a staggering shift. I remember Terry Hearn fishing down at Nutsy Pond down in Totton near Southampton. Yeah. And I know that lake well. And that lake, it was almost impossible to get a bite there at night. And the reason was because it was so rich, so eutrophic, and so full of plants that at night there was no oxygen in that water. So none of the fish were going to dare to feed at night. The last thing they wanted to do was have a gut full of food in the middle of the night, because there would have been no oxygen with which to digest it. It was a really a daylight water only. Suited me perfect.
That was my next question. Very weedy waters, what effect does the night have on those? So you've kind of just answered that. You're saying if places are very weedy, you don't want to be fishing up against the weed bed at night.
No, that's a really, it's a good question, Jamie, because what you often see, and we all fall foul of this, you know, you read the magazines and it tells you, find the fish, locate the fish, find the fish. You get there in the middle of the afternoon and there are all the carp sitting in the thickest weed bed you can possibly find in the lake, and they're absolutely lapping it up because they want to be in nice warm water. And of course, thick weed up on the surface, it gets really warm, that water. And of course, because of the presence of the weed, and the sunlight, the weeds are all photosynthesizing, so they're effectively sitting in a warm bath of heavily oxygenated water. So for the fish, it's perfect. At night, of course, that warm, shallow, weedy water becomes quite poor for them in terms of oxygen content, because the weed obviously is respiring, it sucks the oxygen up, and the water's warm, so it doesn't hold that oxygen well either. And so often you'll see those fish, you'll set up on the fish at dusk, think, here we go, this is looking good. And at 4 o'clock the next morning at bite time, they're all at the other end of the lake feeding out in open water. And, you know, I've certainly done that. And, you know, you thought, oh, I'm going to catch one tonight. First light the next morning, you get a text message from your mate 400 yards away to say, yeah, just had the big one. And you think, bah, humbug.
Yeah. So certain lakes that fish really well in the day and certain lakes that fish well at night. I mean, I've always kind of categorised them as high pressure lakes and low pressure lakes. I mean pressure as in air pressure. So there are certain lakes, St Ives Lagoon being an example. Yateley Car Park Lake used to do more daytime bites than night, well, morning bites really, I would say, up till like 11 a.m. during the year I was on there. I always kind of thought lakes, there's some lakes that fish well in high pressure. You know, those sort of bright sunny days where the pressure's 10:30, and on a lot of lakes you just know you're completely wasting your time, a still day and whatever. And there's certain lakes that used to do bites on those days. Now, Yateley was one, St Ives Lagoon was another one. Do you think that's just the habit of the lake, or do you think it's probably something to do with what we've just spoke about?
I would think it's a lot to do with oxygen content. I mean, for a fish, it wants to eat its food, and then it wants to digest its food at a point in the day when the water is as warm as it can find, and in the richest in terms of its oxygen content. Now, for a carp, it wants to eat its meal and then digest it with the water temperature as close to 27 degrees centigrade as possible, because that is, according to all the literature, pretty close. I mean, different literature will give you slightly different figures, but 27 degrees centigrade is quoted as being the biological optimum for the species. So that means for a carp, it wants to, and if you give them a choice, if you put them in a lake that was very long and thin, and it's 0 degrees at one end and 40 at the other, they'll end up at 27 degrees centigrade. Smaller fish might end up slightly warmer, but the big ones will all end up at 27 degrees centigrade, because that is the best temperature. Not because they think, well, this feels comfortable, because that is the temperature at which the enzymes in this cold-blooded animal work at their biological best. So for a carp, it wants to eat a gutful and then be in a nice oxygen-rich environment at 27 degrees centigrade. So they will do everything they can to make sure that happens, because if they don't, they're not going to succeed. They're not going to make it. So it's Mother Nature, it's selection occurring, it's biological selection. Those fish are, you know, finely tuned into that environmental, those cues, to make sure that they're digesting their food in the warmest place at the best oxygen content. So they'll pick their feeding times around that. The other thing which I think is worth mentioning here is that's also important, but there's also something else which comes in, which is definitely worthy of mention, which is optimal foraging. So the fish, if they're bloodworm feeders, for example, often cue into feeding at night. Now, that might fly in the face a little bit of what we've talked about, because you think, well, at night time, there's less oxygen in the water, so maybe it's not so good for the fish. But of course, if they're eating lots of bloodworm, the bloodworm are hiding in the silt. And bloodworm, a bit like carp, are very finely tuned into the oxygen content of their environment. Bloodworm are designed to live in a low oxygen environment. For a bloodworm, they want to be as deeply buried in the silt as they possibly can be, because that gets them away from cyprinids like carp, tench and bream that are feeding on them. But of course, at night, when the oxygen levels in the water above the silt drop, they drop in the silt layer too. And so the bloodworm have to come to the surface of the silt to survive. If they don't, they suffocate. And of course, when they're on the surface, the carp can have them much easier. So they do less digging for better food.
Everything's very logical, isn't it, when you actually understand kind of what things...
There's a lot going on. It's a complicated web.
Yeah. It's. I mean, that completely explains why bite times change throughout the year.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, my most common time, if I had to add up all the fish that I'd caught over the last 25 years, I would say the bulk of them occur, you know, an hour before first light to an hour after, I would say. And is that just because the oxygen is building there? The carp may have not fed all night, they're hungry because they've not fed for 6 or 7
yeah,
hours?
Yeah, I mean, as a general rule, you know, as you say, I think if you took 20 carp anglers and recorded all their bites through the year, yes, they're going to be odd random ones, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and, you know, the quirky bites that come completely out of the blue. But the majority of bites come, you know, if you looked at the whole year for those 20 anglers, the majority of bites would come at those sort of regular times, wouldn't they? You know, sort of early hours of the morning, first light is a prime time. That sort of hour either side of first light is particularly good for bites. Definitely. You know, I can remember watching a shoal of fish at a lake when I was fishing. I had my rods out, I was up a tree, and I remember a fish breaking away from a group, swimming over to the baited spot, dropping down, and the next thing I get a one noter and I'm scrambling down the tree 100 miles an hour to hit the rod. I knew which fish it was going to be because I'd see it swim over, but that fish was, I think he was just like, you know, I just fancy a little snack. I'm not feeding, I just want a snack. Yeah, I just want to go and check it out. Oh, there's a boilie, wallop. You know, that wasn't a group of feeding fish, but, and I just watched that one fish peel away, swim over to the baited spot and wallop. But, you know, that the feeding time for the rest of that group was first light, and that's you know, that was a lucky catcher. But most of the bites come at those regular times. And as you say, that ties up with what the oxygen content of the water is doing at that point.
So as we're moving into colder water now, obviously winter's on its way soon. What's your thought on cold water feeding? How often do they need to eat? Will they only eat when there's a slight change in temperature that day? I'm presuming there's plenty of oxygen in the winter. Once the weeds died down, is there kind of a prime time we should be looking at in the winter?
As a general rule, Jamie, I think we've got this period now, we're in now, so where are we? So back end of October. And I think you're right when you say, you know, we're not quite in the winter, it's autumn time now. You've got a period when I know lakes can often switch off. So you've got often a lot of rotting weed, you've got a lot of leaves going into the water, and I'm afraid, I love trees, don't get me wrong, but leaves are rubbish for oxygen content in a lake. They destroy it. And I've tested it out. I've put leaves in buckets and monitored the oxygen over several weeks, and leaves rip the oxygen out of the water. The bacteria that break leaves down really suck up a lot of oxygen. So you get leaf fall, it can be a tricky time for the fish. Oxygen levels will be surprisingly low despite the fact that the water's cool. But once you've got through that, as you rightly sort of mentioned, the oxygen levels should be, because the water's cold, pretty good. And you know, do the carp feed through the winter? Well, certainly on the farm and through my own fishing experience, I've caught plenty of fish when it's been very, very cold, so they will feed right through the winter. And I think that they travel about a great deal less. But generally, I think they will snack most days. I think that the food takes quite a long time to go through the gut transient time. So the amount of time it takes from the food to enter the mouth to pass through the whole of the gut of the fish can become quite a long period. So they're not necessarily going to eat loads and loads every single day. But if there is a regular trickle of bait going in, then they will, you know, they'll make the most of that. Definitely. So, you know, I think, you know, the sort of short sessions in the winter, I'm a great fan of those, because if you can suss out when they are going to feed, whether it's at dusk or, you know, middle of the day, those sorts of periods, then it's worth going for sure.
Can you feed them up with certain types of bait? So if you feed them something like boilies, really nutritious, is that going to take longer to digest, make them not feed for a few days, as opposed to if you gave them some particle or something?
I'm quite a fan of particles in the winter, so I've historically used Vitalin lots in the winter. Vitalin and sweet corn, I've had really good results on that in the winter. And that seems to pass through the fish relatively simply. It's not complicated food, and it's very natural, and that seems to go quite well. It also keeps the coots busy for hours and hours and hours. So I'm quite a fan of that. I think, you know, I know there's always going to be exceptions, and I know there'll be people listening to this going, well, I put 10 kilos every other day out on the carp or on it all the time, but at the venues I fish, that hasn't worked that well. But yeah, certainly a steady supply, regular supply of bait, I think is very good. And don't get too complicated with it. I think try and keep it simple, but keep it regular. I think that's the most important.
And is there a magical temperature figure coming out of the winter into the spring? Is there a number that you look for before you know that, you know, they're feeding properly again, or
we at the farm we feed catching? Yeah, at the farm we feed pretty much right through the winter. Obviously, if it's bitterly cold, we'll slow right down, and if we get milder spells, you know, it's fairly common. So if you get nice southwesterlies and a few low pressure systems coming through, then we'll put a bit more food in the ponds. But I think the thing that you see a lot is that light levels play an enormously important part for them. They clock the light level changes very quickly.
Right.
I think, you know, we as humans, we've lost track completely with the sort of the cycle of light through the year, because of course we just turn on a switch and we've got light at 10 o'clock at night in January if we want it. But for Mother Nature outdoors, that the changes in the light levels are really significant. And I think I notice in our garden at home, where as soon as you get past the shortest day, so really, really, you know, late December, early January, you're seeing changes in, for example, the blue tits and grey tits, the robins are singing a little bit more crisply. The blackbirds are starting to go, here, I'm the biggest man, this is my territory, you know, I'm looking for a mate. And they've already noticed that change. Now, carp are, you know, are triggered to spawn by temperature. They're temperature spawners, so once we get to 18 degrees centigrade, that's the cue that they need. But other cyprinids, closely related cyprinids like orf or roach, are actually photoperiod spawners. So that means that they're triggered to spawn not by changes in temperature, but by changes in daylight. And they're quite closely related to carp. So although the carp isn't actually triggered to spawn by day length, it's obviously, you know, it's in its hormones, it's in its brain to clock those changes in daylight. And then I think as soon as we see the day starting to get a little bit longer in January, late January, certainly into February, we start to see a big increase in the activity of fish at the farm. You know, they're starting to become more active. And although the water can still be quite cold at that point, you know, obviously February, you can get bitterly cold weather, but you're starting to see on those bright sunny days, you walk around the farm and you're starting to see fish moving about more then. And that's certainly the point we start to trickle a bit more food in. From an angling point of view, if I ever get a sort of 5 degree centigrade increase, you know, across a few days, then that's as good as it's possibly going to get in the winter. If you get a nice, you know, really high pressure cold weather, and then you get a low pressure and the temperature goes up a few degrees outside, and that's bringing the water temperature up, that's as good as it's going to get. That's a fantastic chance.
And do you think the first day it goes cold again after a mild period in the winter, do you think that's also a trigger to feel?
I think it can be. It's often a day when it's been really horrible. It's sometimes quite difficult to watch the water and get on the fish as well. When you get that first cold day afterwards, they've become a little bit more active. They might be showing, and you can spot them. I sometimes wonder if that plays a part. You know, you're sat in your bivvy with the bat, everything's battened down because you're sitting out for stormy weather.
Yeah.
You can't really watch the water that well, and if one jumps, it doesn't. You know, the disturbance is so rough out there, it's hard to spot. But you get a couple of cool, you know, the bright days after that, and the water's like a mirror. And one Head and Shoulders, you're straight on it, aren't you? So, and of course, they become a little bit more active then. So I think that plays a part.
And what can they see? I mean, in reference to colours, to different coloured baits that we use, I mean, how good is their eyesight?
Well, if you believe the research, which is, you know, what I've obviously read up on, that they've got a relatively good colour vision. So their eyesight is designed to work in a lower light environment to our own. So, you know, what we see on the bank in terms of brightness and colours is different to theirs. They're designed to work in an environment that is a lower light level. So obviously light doesn't penetrate water as like it does in the air. So they live in a duller world than what we're used to seeing. But I think it's fair to say, certainly in shallow, clear water, they've got relatively good colour vision. And I've played about, I've written about this lots in the past, but I've played about with putting hook shanks, for example, on half a pound or 1 pound nylon, you know, really light nylon, and lowering those hook shanks into aquariums with fish in, and they've taken the hook shank, they swim up to it and suck it off the bottom. So they've they've got pretty good vision, and you know, they're 5 pound carp, and they swim straight up to the shank of a size 4 hook or a size 6 hook, size 6 I think it probably was, and you know, so you've got the bend carp is just the straight, the eye and the straight bit of metal, and they've sucked it straight off the bottom, and you think, okay, so their eyesight's not that shabby.
So it makes you think of when I remember when we first started using plastic, you know, like unflavoured bits of yellow plastic, and the first time I cast out and had a bite with no bait around it, it blew my mind. Is that just pure inquisitiveness?
Yeah, I think listen, Jamie, if you walk down the street and you're walking along a street and you see a £20 note on the floor, do you just carry on past it?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Well, you wouldn't, would you? No. So you'd pick it up. But you'd pick it up and inspect it and then go, oh, I've been had. It's not a £20 note. Of course, by that point, you're hooked.
So they just see it and think it could be food.
There's some sweet corn. I'll have that.
Yeah.
Don't forget that we're all... I don't know about you, you're a proficient angler, but when I'm baiting up, bait goes everywhere. So, you know, you get grains of sweet corn laid all over the shot, and, you know, be it sweet corn or a single boiler. And I think, you know, they haven't got hands, so they're swimming along, and there's something that looks like a bit of sweet corn. You know, the only way they can test it out is to suck it up. In the same way, you walk past that £20 note, you go, there's a £20 note, you pick it up. As soon as you picked it up, that size 6 is in your bottom lip. So, you know, a single bait, I think, is such an effective weapon for catching them, because they can't, particularly with a single bait, it's not a feeding situation, and often they take it when they're moving. And one of the things I learned a long time ago, if you put a big tight patch of bait, fish come in and they hoover on it, but they don't move very much. And often, I see this a lot when I'm stalking, I'll put a tight patch of bait on a little gravel spot, but often if I'm fishing with two rods, I put one rod on it and one a meter or two up the bank, and 9 times out of 10 it's the one up the bank that goes, because as they're coming in or leaving the spot, they'll take the extra sausage, if you like, but I'll just have one more and bang, that's them caught. Whereas once they're actually on the spot and feeding, they're tricky customers to catch. You want a moving carp's a much easier fish to hook than one that's sat still.
And do you think when we use like washed out baits, you know, especially like pink and white hook baits or pastely colours instead of bright, do you think, I mean, obviously you're saying their eyesight can probably distinguish, do you think they relate that to danger, that baits that's been in longer
I think there's
safer?
Yeah, I mean, I've not used washed out baits a lot myself, but I've got friends that have certainly put, you know, put a massive amount of emphasis on it and have said it's really changed their fishing, and it makes good sense, doesn't it? This is, you know, there's research out there that shows that carp can learn very quickly from one bad experience. So if, you know, if you get caught on a bright red or a, you know, whatever the colour is, a bright, dark, rich coloured bait, you get caught on it and you think, well, that wasn't a lot of fun. So you become nervous of it. So you then start, you know, they learn through association. They don't get caught on the baits that have lost their flavour and have been in the water a long time. And I think, you know, you take your, if you imagine your, we've mentioned Oxleys, somewhere like Oxleys, where you've got lots of anglers coming in through the gate all the time. There's bait going out in all the swims a lot of the time that isn't getting eaten very quickly. So there's bait sitting on the bottom, and the fish move through and they find baits that may have been in the water a week. And of course, they hoover them up and don't get caught. So they, you know, they must, it's almost like we're educating them that actually the bait that's been in the water a week is the safest bait to eat, because we bait up.
That's interesting.
You know, I think I was out, Jamie, this last weekend. I fished Friday, Saturday, and I didn't catch, but I put in probably a kilo of boilies over two spots, and so not particularly generous with the bait, but it didn't get eaten. The coots weren't on it. That could still be sat on the bottom of the lake now. You know, and the fish have moved through that area now and gone, oh, look, some bait. It's all washed out. This is safe. And, of course, they have it for free, so... I think
we're one of the few European countries that kind of have boilies like that don't break down. In Europe, it's very it's very common to have. I was over in Romania a couple of years back, and they can't get their head around the fact that we put these baits out that are still there a week later. they don't make their boilies with eggs. They look like our boilies. They're hard, but they use I forget what it is now. They replace the egg with something else. I mean, the boilies break down after about 12 hours. Do you think that'd be better for us?
Well, I suppose the boy, difficult one. I think probably from the fish getting big point of view, and I know from on the farm, so we take this back to the fish farm for a moment, I want to use a pellet that stays whole as a pellet for at least 24 hours. And the reason for that is if I feed the fish on the same spot every day, they become educated to come to those spots for their food. But some of our growing ponds at the farm are large, and they react like fisheries. So the fish move about through the course of 24 hours. So they go to the warmest places or the places with the most oxygen, as we've already touched on. So they're not always necessarily sitting there waiting for their food. When I put that food in, I want it to stay as a pellet that is nutritionally of high value to those fish for as long as possible. If it breaks down to mush on the bottom, I'm going to pollute the pond, and the fish aren't going to be able to gain the benefit from that expensive pellet I've put in. So the diets we use, we pick pellets that stay as pellets for as long as we can get them. And we're using a carp diet now that it stays whole on the bottom for at least 24 hours. So you put it in, and if a carp take 10 hours to come across the feeding area, or they've been up in the shallows enjoying the sunshine, and they come around in the evening for their food, it's still there, and the pellet is still intact. It's an integral diet that they can suck up, hoover off the bottom, and get the benefit of. If it's gone to slop, then you're just polluting the pond. So I would say, to take that now across to fishing, from the fish benefit from boilies that stay whole, because if they eat them after 3 or 4 days, then they're gaining the benefit of that, nutritional food. They're going to eat those fish meals if they're 3 days old, and that's, a good protein source. It's got carbohydrates, lipids, vitamins, minerals, so it's going to be doing them good. If it broke down after 12 hours, then you could argue that places like Oxley's that are maybe heavily fished with loads of bait going down, that could be quite polluting of the water if it all breaks down and becomes inedible to the fish.
So that's a different way of looking at it. I like that.
Make more boilies, throw them in quick.
Yeah, I was thinking that their thinking was probably better, but if you're saying it's going to pollute the water anyway when it breaks down, then it's better to have them whole and sucked up, or worst case scenario, they're going to float up after a certain period of time anyway if uneaten, aren't they?
Yeah, well, if they break down after 12 hours, the birds can't even pick them up then. If let's say the tufties find your bait after 2 days and then they clear your spot, it's been eaten. At least it's not going off in the environment. It's not going to waste in the environment.
You may or may not be aware of a previous Carpcast. We had Mark Holmes on, and then we had Daryl afterwards. Mark said some quite controversial things that he's found, or just off the wall things that I think was a surprise to most people, but about he believes male carp being sort of predatory. They eat a lot more fish than we believe.
I think both sexes do. Males and females love fish.
Right, and he's saying males, when they get tricky to catch. I mean, I've had this experience myself where the biggest fish in the lake's a male, and it's the least caught fish. It's elusive, and it's the biggest, and it still gets bigger. So I'm like, how? What is it feeding on? And Mark's statement of, they a lot of live fry and fish makes total sense to me.
He's right, they definitely do.
And he's saying that's how he's caught. He did kind of give the impression that you're more likely to catch on, big male carp on fish than actual boilies. And I think that's where Daryl said he's never had anything so crazy. He's caught loads of big male fish on there. But do you believe male and females have different habits?
I think they can. They do definitely. I mean, there's different things going on in the bodies of the two fish, aren't there? A female carp is fundamentally, once she has spawned, and if you let's just very generally say that a female carp, the ovaries are about 25% of her body weight. So if we take a 40-pound car, no, there'll be guys that go, oh, that's rubbish, but if we just generally say a 40-pound car, a female fish, when she spawns, her weight is going to drop to 30 pounds. Now, I can think of loads of examples of, you know, fish that drop 25%. I mean, there'll be some that drop 20% and some that drop 15%, but there'll be others that drop 30% of their body weight. So it obviously depends on the body shape of the fish. But for a female carp, she has then got to rebuild that enormous weight loss through food. And the only way she can do that is obviously eating. And the easiest route for her to do that is to eat boilies that don't swim away. So if you are a female carp, you spawn, you obviously get rid of 25% of your body weight, which is all high energy yolk, which you've obviously provided for your fry. That's given them the best start in life. You've got to then rebuild those ovaries. Now, initially, in the once the fish have spawned through the summer, there's an element of rebuilding the genetic material within the eggs before the eggs actually swell up with yolk. So there's a period when the females are rebuilding their ovaries, the actual sort of the building blocks of the eggs before they actually start to pack them with yolk. But once we get to that point, sort of towards the end of the summer and into the autumn, female carp have got an enormous requirement for calories to build up those eggs with yolk. And you see that in fish weights. So carp, I remember, and we mentioned Daryl. Daryl caught fish out of down in Ringwood. What's the name of the lake there? Very famous lake. It's left me. Rockford. Those fish. Rockford, those fish put on huge weight gains in the autumn. You know, like a pound, in, and then they get caught by somebody else, and there's another pound increase, and you think, oh, wow, they're growing quick. What those fish are doing is they are fueling the eggs in their ovaries with yolk. They're pumping yolk into the ovaries to build up that egg mass. So they should, certainly in the southern half of the UK, by the autumn, you've got fish that have pumped their eggs just about ready to spawn again. So in theory, if I was to take a fish out of Rockford in November time, I could inject it with hormones and it would spawn again. It'd be ready to spawn. Of course, in nature, that doesn't happen because the water temperatures are coming down and the fish are starting to shut down for the winter. But they've done all that building work. Now, that takes, as we've said, a massive amount of energy and calories to do that. Now, if you're a female carp, you're quite a deep-bodied fish. You could swim around trying to catch roach and rudd to do that, or you could swim over to Daryl's baited area and hoover up 5 kilos of boilies, which is the easiest. And I'm afraid most female fish probably take B, because if they can get away without getting caught, then that's the easiest route to getting a meal.
Yeah.
So it kind of touches back to optimal foraging, you know, that it's getting the most calories for the minimum amount of work.
Would it make sense to you that male fish would likely go, especially when they've probably never, ever been hooked? Do you believe the fish are smarter, first of all, when they're bigger? They learn by mistakes, I guess?
I think there's an element of that, but I also, slightly controversially perhaps, they get more stupid as they get older. So if you think about your own life, when you're a young person, you do daft things and you learn through your mistakes. Yeah. Then in the middle of your life, you're potentially your most sharpest, you've learnt lots, and then as you go into your twilight years, you start to become a bit fluffy around the edges and make mistakes. And exactly the same thing happens with carp. And you see that all over the country with fish populations. As big, really big old fish start to come towards the end of their lives, they start to get a bit silly and they do stupid things, and they get caught, often get caught more, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And I think that's just, you know, I like to put the human spin on it because it kind of helps people kind of get their head around it. But if you're a doddery old person, with the greatest respect to elderly people, my grandmother, before she left us, she'd fall over. She couldn't see what temperature the cooker was at. She'd do daft things. I'm looking at it thinking, come on, Gran, this is easy. Because I'm in my 30s at that point and she's in her 80s. You know, and she's gone woolly around the edges. She's lost that sharpness that you get in the middle of your life. And I think really old carp, very big fish, they become quite clumsy when they're really big and old. And also, you know, their eyesight might be compromised at that point in their life as well. So, you know, it starts to get more and more tricky for them as they get really towards the end of their lives. But the fish thing, Jamie. sorry, to go back to the fish thing, though, I know of every winter I've got friends that go fishing for all sorts of species, and every winter lots of guys catch carp on fish baits, and not always dead baits either. I can think of a couple of occasions last year when a friend locally to Winchester caught nice carp actually on live baits being fished for perch. So, you know, and that definitely goes towards what Mark had mentioned. And interestingly, another friend of mine who does health checks, so he dissects carp for, you know, his job is to look for parasites in the guts of fish. He gets fish to dissect every winter, and from two or three venues which have produced relatively big carp, he often finds the guts of the fish are absolutely from mouth to arse stuffed with rudd and roach.
Wow.
But
wow, that's pretty amazing. I mean,
from end to end, literally the entire length of the gut of these, it's a lake that produces some big commons. His health check fish, and on a couple of occasions, they have been stuffed from one end to the other with rudd and roach. So they are clearly eating them.
Wow. Commons and mirrors, then. Are they a different species? I mean, relatively speaking.
I think, I don't know. It's very difficult to... I mean, genetically, they're the same thing. I mean, I can produce commons and mirrors from the same bowl of eggs. So, you know, their parents are the same. But I think they're possibly their taste buds vary slightly. You know, I think possibly their taste in food and what they might eat. You know, I love the fact that every lake's got an elusive monster common.
Yeah, I mean, I've caught a fair few big commons. I would probably three different commons over £48 in the last 20 years, and I've always seemed to catch them. And you know, these fish that other anglers have struggled with on the same lake, even though I've told them what I'm doing. And I mean, speaking to Gary Bays a lot, he says there's definitely certain flavours that they can put in their baits that commons seem to prefer. You know, the field tests of the fish lakes have got a pretty even stock of both, and you know, they're catching more commons on one bay. They've swapped it over, and you know, they start catching the mirrors off the same spot they were catching the commons off. And
yeah,
I've heard that story so many times, so it makes sense if you say that they potentially got just different tastes.
Yeah, and I've seen exactly the same. In fact, I've used baits that I've on lakes that have had an even split. And I've caught predominantly mirrors one year, and then I've changed, and then I've caught predominantly commons. And that, it's too black and white to be just that's just the way it was. I'm sure that one of the baits was picked, the mirrors preferred, and one of the other baits the commons preferred.
And I've seen it on lakes as well, where you know, quite often you'll have, I don't know, half a dozen big mirrors in a lake, and but there'll be a 3-week period in the year where only the commons get caught, nothing else, none of the mirrors come out, and then all of a sudden the mirrors will all come out in a row over a week or two. I can't explain why that is. I've just seen it happen so many times. You know, it's or even differentiate between big fish and small fish. You'll see all the 20s get caught, and then the big ones will come out once all the 20s have been caught. I mean, is there anything scientific you can explain these habits by?
Cool. Very, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because every lake is different and every population is different, but you know, different size fish at different periods in their life are doing, you know, different stuff, I suppose. And, you know, and also in their reproductive cycle, you know, we've spoken about fish refueling their ovaries in the autumn. You know, if you're a big fish and you've got a lot of weight to put on, then you're eating a lot of boilies, then you are vulnerable to getting caught, aren't you? You know, and depending on how well tuned into natural food. Another thing we haven't mentioned, but it kind of ties in with the age thing, which I think plays a part, is the degree to which their mouths might be compromised through years of being caught. Because often you see that the really rarely caught fish have got absolutely immaculate mouths. And I think a lot of the time that means that their oral processing of bait, and therefore rigs, is better than a fish that's possibly been caught a few times. You know, I think if you get caught early on your life, and your mouth gets a bit damaged, maybe you have a run-in with a snag and, you know, you get a damaged mouth, then that compromises that fish's ability to feed, and therefore it probably relies more on angler's bait, because it's easier to eat angler's bait than to be silt feeding for bloodworm, for example. So they become more reliant on angler's bait, and of course as a factor then they get caught more as well.
And if their mouths are their hands effectively, and they become desensitized, they're not as efficient at getting rid of rigs, maybe.
Exactly. And if you take a fish that, you know, the mouth of a carp makes, you know, there's an element here where you think, well, possibly we shouldn't fish for these things at all if we really love them. Their mouth is an incredibly fantastically designed apparatus for feeding on the substrate, on the mud and the bottom of a pond. It's designed with many small bones in it, loads of taste buds with the barbels and everything else. It's a beautifully designed tool for extracting, for example, bloodworm from silt, and we clump it with a size 6, you know, we are potentially going to damage that mouth. And a fish that's got a badly damaged mouth, he's going to come, as you say, it's desensitized, and because it's badly damaged, it takes the easiest food option. It can't feed so efficiently on bloodworm in the silt, for example, so it tends to turn to the easy option, which of course is a boilie, because it's quite a high nutritional value bait, and you do less work for your boilies, but of course it gets caught more as a payout for that, so it becomes the mugfish of the lake, for want of a better expression.
Yeah, we've seen that a lot. You know, this is a fish affectionately known as the parrot in various lakes across the country. Quite often the friendly ones, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, something I've spoke about a lot over the years as well is some of the hardest fish to catch, which are quite often the biggest in various lakes. I can name a few. That paddle at Jim caught, the 50 common being one of them. They've all got one thing in common, which is that overslung mouth, that hoover-shaped kind of mouth. And I found those to be the hardest carp to catch. You know, there's many fish that I know that are once every 2 year type fish, maybe the biggest fish in the lake as well. They've got that mouth in common, and it must be even more efficient at dealing with rigs and stuff than maybe a conventional shaped mouth. I mean, have you come across that?
I'd agree. I've seen exactly the same. That slightly overshot mouth, it does. Yeah. It seems to give them a better ability. Whether the top lip can brush the bottom lip to knock a rig out, I'm not sure, but they seem to be able to just get rid of that hook that much more easily. And certainly stalking, I mean, you know yourself, you've been doing it a long time. When you're stalking, you can put some of the best rigs, you can pick up a copy of the latest magazine, copy the best rig in the world, put it in the margin on a clean spot, set it all up, and you watch a carp come along, hoover it up, get hooked, spit it out and swim off, and you think, okay.
How effective are our rigs?
I think on those occasions, probably not very, but I think, you're seeing, I always think with stalking, you're seeing carp fishing in fast forward. It's like everything happens so much more quickly. If you cast out and you sit down and you have a cup of tea and you chat to your mate and you text your friend and you watch the water, and after 4 or 5 hours you get a one-noter, you think, brilliant, I've caught one, happy days, I'm off the mark. But if you're stalking the edge, in those 3 or 4 hours, you might have had 10 opportunities and you might have been picked up a couple of times and spat out. And, you know, so you're just, it's like seeing it in fast forward. It's all happening much, much quicker. So I think, you know, from my point of view, I love it because it's exciting. It's very interactive fishing, isn't it? Rather than just sitting there. To get a fish come onto a baited spot, even if you don't catch it and have a chance, you know, I can think of times when I've seen huge fish come onto my baited spots and I've not caught them. But those few moments when it's been feeding and it's tipped up right by your rig and your heart is just pounding so much, you can feel your temples feel like they're about to explode. And then after a couple of minutes, it rights itself and just paddles off up the margin and you didn't get the bite. And you're thinking, my God, that's an enormous carp. That is, you know, you would never see that out in the middle. So it's worth its weight in gold.
No. So them days when you've done a 48-hour session without a bleep, you know, but maybe back in the Yately days where there was like, you know, a few commons and 9 mirrors, how many times do you think that fish or a fish has swam over your spot in that 48 hours and looked at it or picked at some food on the spot and just gone, nah,
not today.
A bit moody that.
not having that today, thank you.
is that that's probably happening constantly, I guess.
I think so. Obviously, as you say, it depends a lot on the stocking density and how many fish are there. And obviously, if you're not on the fish, it's not happening. But I think if you're in if the water quality is good and the conditions are right for the fish to feed, so there's oxygen and, you know, they're up for it, then, yeah, I think that they'll often visit a spot and check it out. And certainly when you're stalking, you see that. They come over a spot and they might pick up a couple of baits and drift off. And, yeah, when it's out in the middle of the pond, it's probably happening a lot more than we like to think. You know, then sometimes you get those little lifts and you think, what was that? And you never know.
Yeah,
but yeah, you can't hit them all.
I won't keep you much longer because this has been a fantastic, you know, I'm sat here with a big grin on my face, like so many light bulbs are going off in my head, and I know your time's
listenership is still awake. They might have fallen asleep at this point.
Oh no, they'll be loving this is a fantastic chat. Will there ever be a magic ingredient that carp just can't resist?
Oh, great question. No. there are already hundreds of magical ingredients, and I think they are all magical until the poor old fish have been caught on them a few times and they've learned that lesson. I think you know, you talk to people, you go back many years and talk to people that first time they started using sweet corn, I've heard of people say it was almost like cheating. It was too easy. They were just hanging themselves. You know, that was at that point, that was the magic ingredient, the little golden grains. And, you know, but obviously once they've all been caught on it a few times, it becomes, you know, another past bait. It's still very effective, but they've seen it. And I think any new bait is, you know, I'd say to people, you know, you can put twists on all those old particles, boilies. There's so much you can do now to your bait to try and make it a bit different or a bit unique. And I think anything like that is always worth doing, because it can be a small percentage change in the bait that you're using that makes it a bit different to what everybody else is doing. And I think, you know, that's been said many times in the past, but if you do the same as everybody else, your results are going to be the same as everybody else's. If you can try and be that just tiny bit outside the box, then that can make a massive difference, because this is only something with a brain the size of a pea, and it isn't going to be Einstein. So if you can just change the equation just a fraction so that it makes it just slightly outside its sphere of experience, then you're going to make it slip up. And whether it's going to long hook links and light running leads, or changing the ingredients, or flavoring your sweet corn or your tiger nuts or whatever, or changing the boilie mix slightly, then a little change can make a big, big difference, definitely.
And what about salt? Do they need it? You know, all this talk about, you know, putting salt in your baits prior to spawning or post-spawning. What's your opinion?
I mean, the carp is more salty than the water it's swimming about in. So they have to osmoregulate. So that means that for a carp swimming along, there is water trying to diffuse into it all the time. So carp have to wee lots to get rid of that water, and they have to retain salt. So there is some advantage to them in eating some slightly salty stuff. We also know that carp can live in brackish water, so they're able to deal with reasonably high levels of salt in their environment. I'm not so sure. I think they do find it attractive. I certainly put some in with my particles, and I like ready salted crisps. So I think, you know, it is a flavour enhancer, and I think it, you know, to some extent they like the taste of it. But I'm not convinced. It's like, you know, clay rubbing spots. I'm not altogether sure that they go to the clay rubbing spots to get nutrients. I think it's more to do with parasites. But, you know, I think, again, it's just about being a bit different, isn't it? And if you make your bait a bit different, it's a bit more salty than somebody else's, then it might be a different direction to go in.
Do you do lots of testing on with bait on your...
Yeah, definitely. I've done in the past too much. Far too much, and I've got far too much hung up over one or two ingredients. So, and actually the most important thing I was ever taught as a young lad getting into carp fishing was use your eyes, because that is the most important piece of kit that you're ever given. And you know, the best bait in the world is useless if you put it in the wrong spot. I've certainly spent a lot of time hanging over the side of a pond and putting baits down, and I've watched baits that are meant to be amazing not really interest the fish at all, and then I've watched other baits that you'd think, well, you know, that shouldn't be that attractive to them, and the fish are going absolutely loop the loop. I remember, bore you with a little story here, Jamie, but the very first time I cooked up some tiger nuts, and we started this conversation with discussion about kitchen chaos at my home where I grew up, but yeah. I cooked some tiger nuts. I managed to blag my mother to lend me the pressure cooker. And then on her cooker, I then followed some instructions in probably one of the very first Nutribates catalogues on how to cook tiger nuts. And I'd gone to the shop and bought my little bottle of, I think it was sweet cajows, and I put a few drips in and done what I was told. And I created the most holy mess in our kitchen at home. And I produced this little pressure cooker full of tiger nuts. And they'd all swelled up, and I looked at the picture in the magazine. I thought, I've done it. These look amazing. They're rock hard still, but they look and smell amazing. Obviously, my mother went absolutely ballistic. I ruined the pressure cooker. Anyway, at that point in my life, I was doing weekend work at a garden centre that sold koi carp. And yeah. I took a little bag of my tiger nuts with me, and I showed them to a friend I work with there called Terry. And I said, look, Terry, I've made some tiger nuts. I've cooked these things up. Look, you know, and he sniffed them and we went, they smell amazing. We hadn't got a clue what they were going to be like. And I got a pan net. Now, we had the koi, were in holding vats, and they were netted out of the vats using a shallow pan net, so they don't sort of get scooped up like a landing net. They're kind of held on a shallow pan to prevent the fish getting damaged fins. So what we did, we set up this really clever tank test. It was the very first tank test I ever did. So we put a handful of tiger nuts in this shallow pan net, and we positioned it so it just sat, so the bottom of the pan net was just touching the water, and we got out the way. Now, this is the net that those koi were absolutely terrified of, because of course they thought they're about to be scooped out and sold off when it came in the tank. So we set up this thing, put our tiger nuts in this pan net, and we sat back and watched as those fish went absolutely ballistic for those tiger nuts. They ended up dragging the net into the tank to get to those tiger nuts. Now, those were imported koi that had come from Japan, and I can't find anywhere in the literature to suggest that Japanese koi farmers feed their fish on tiger nuts. So that was the very first time that those fish had ever, ever come across a tiger nut, and they were almost to the point of getting themselves in a net just to get to them.
Wow.
Great bait.
I mean, that's my... tiger nuts probably the bait I've caught the most fish on in my life, and if somebody said one bait forever, I'd probably pick a tiger nut, I think.
Oh, I would, absolutely, without doubt. And the versatility of them, you know, it doesn't matter if there's roach or tench in the lake, you with a tiger nut you can go everywhere, they last forever. Yeah, brilliant bait, and they bloody love them.
Yeah, I'm not sure if, because, you know, they tend to crap them out whole, don't they? So I'm not sure they have any value to the
carp. Not in my experience, they chop them up. They should chop them up. The pharyngeal teeth should crush them.
Just crunch them up, yeah. I mean, it was always said in the books when I was young, but that they love crunching things. Do you think we could get the perfect boilie that had a hard, crunchy outside, you know, like soft on the inside? Do you think
they'd
really like?
I think there's quite a bit goes on, because they've obviously got fantastic hearing, and a fish that is crunching, I've set this up in the garden pond and in tanks and listened. A fish crunching a pellet makes a lot of noise underwater. A lot, you can really hear crunch, crunch, crunch. So I've had aquariums, I've turned the pumps off, all the air lines off, and I've fed them on tiger nuts, I've fed them on pellets. And if you listen, you can hear the bait being crunched up. So, for example, a tiger nut, if you crunch tiger nuts in your teeth, they make a crunching noise. It's exactly the same noise that a 10-pound carp makes when it crunches it up in its pharyngeal teeth. That sound travels a very long way underwater, and I think that is incredibly attractive to other fish. And if I was to feed one of my pet fish in the garden pond just one bait and slip it down into its mouth without the others noticing, which itself would be quite an achievement, the moment it started chewing it up, all the other fish in the pond would spin round. They know exactly what's going on. So, you know, they're tuned into that noise. So, I think having a bait that crunches is a good thing.
Obviously, fish are very aware in their own environment, you know, it's their surroundings, just like you kind of know somebody been in your house when you weren't in or something, you'd feel it, I think, you'd just be aware that something wasn't quite right. Do you think they're aware, you know, let's say you've got a 50 acre lake and you're regularly baiting one corner. Do you think they know when you've put that bait in, even if they're not in that corner of the lake?
It depends how far away they are. I think if they're right at the other end, then possibly not. But you know, if you bait up, for example, you use a spom or a spod or, you know, whatever the way is you bait up, that sound is quite distinct and it travels, as I say, quite a long way underwater. If you ever go, let's say you're snorkeling on your summer holidays and someone goes past in a boat, you can hear the sound of that, the engine,
yeah,
a long way away under the water, can't you? So those noises travel a long distance, and if you're putting your bait in a certain way, you know, the fish will hear that. I at the farm, if you drive along some of the ponds, obviously our feeding route around the farm, it varies. Some ponds are not so, the fish don't get quite the same exposure to the noise of the truck as they do on other ponds before you feed them. But on several of the ponds, we drive along one of the arms of the pond, and as you're driving down towards the pond, the fish are already setting off towards the feeding spot. They're bow waving along the surface. They can hear the truck coming. So, you know, it's not quite as it's not a 50 acre lake, but I think if you regularly bait in one spot and you do the same thing every time, it must be like a dinner gong to them.
So I had a scenario on the Pleasure Beach in Blackpool where I live, which is like the big like Alton Towersy type fun fair. There's carp dotted around there and under various rides in sort of lakes that are built below the rides and stuff.
Right.
Certain points where you can feed them. They've been in there since the 60s, some of them. He had some quite big ones that the guy who owned it has moved out to his own. He is actually a carp angler, I think. He's got them, he moved them into his house. But there's still like loads of 20s under there now. There's like fish, like pellet feeding machines at the side of him. You can, you know, put 50p and get a handful of pellets and pretty much hand feed these fish. So these fish are used to it. They've been fed for a lot of years like that, and obviously never been fished for, so they're very tame. I remember pouring some ice cream. We'd gone down there for an ice cream on a hot day, and the melted ice cream in the bottom, I ended up pouring it into the water. Now, there was no fish within about 30 yards, but I could see them like 30 yards away. And when I poured this sort of milky melted ice cream in, it made a cloud instantly. Like, it really spread out, as it does when you put a sort of milky carnation type thing in your spod mix or whatever. But these fish all instantly turned round, and they went crazy amongst the cloud. Even though there's no kind of actual food for them to eat, it seemed to trigger them even more. You know, this liquid that they wanted to eat, they knew was, you know, sweet smelling goodness, and there was nothing solid to eat, and it just seemed to drive them into a frenzy. Going by what you said, I'm guessing it's the sound of the stuff being poured in that first alerted them, as opposed to the smell. I mean, how far away do you think they can smell from?
Oh, quite a long way, but not in an instant. That would have taken a few moments to get across, you know, a minute or two, right, to try the flavour to spread across the scent of that ice cream. But yeah, it's probably the noise of it going in that attracted their attention. What flavour ice cream was it?
I think it was just vanilla.
Oh, right, I'm on the vanilla ice cream this winter.
Oh, they went crazy, and it really made me think. I've never really used liquids extensively. You know, I've soaked boilers and stuff. You know, back in the sort of late 80s on Horseshoe, we used to use like Nod Oil and stuff, and literally pour, you know, bottles of it all over our bait. We'd catapult them in or spot them in, and it used to make a flat spot on what was a pretty windy lake. And we'd float a fish for them in the, you know, you'd make a 30 yard square flat spot with this oil, and then we'd catch them off the top in this, even though it was a windy day or whatever. And they used to go crazy in that, but there was something about this liquid. It didn't fill them up, obviously, but they wanted to eat, and it drove them crazy. And must have been 20, 30 fish literally going loopy, like pushing each other out of the way, like ramming each other, just circling it. They were agitated in a happy way, and it made me think about, you know, I've read articles of people using just liquid in solid PVA bags. But I'm guessing you need something that disperses nicely in whatever the water temperature is. You know, you don't want to be using an oil in the middle of winter.
No, but ice cream sounds perfect.
Yeah, well,
it seems a bit ironic to feed them something freezing cold in the middle of January.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hot day, that's why it all melted. But yeah, I just poured it in. It was in a tub, and I just poured it in, and it was just a liquid. But it was just the way the liquid spread. As soon as it hit the water, it you know, like the first few drops covered maybe a meter square, and as soon as the fish got in it, they went crazy. But
I bet they did.
Flavoured liquids, but you've not done much experimenting with liquids.
Oh, I've done a fair bit, yeah, in the pond, but over the years, yeah, I've had various things that, you know, certainly invoke a similar response, definitely. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the shelves at the average bait, you know, tackle shop now, there are so many good products that will, you know, get that really good response from the fish. But you know, I going back to what I said earlier, I think you can, people trying to, they get almost get obsessed with getting the best rig and the best bait. And I often get guys say to me, oh, you know, what bait would you use? What rig would you use? And I always go back to the same thing I was taught. The best thing you can do in your fishing is just learn to look. You know, so you watch someone, a brilliant angler like Adam Penning or Daryl, they are just on the water looking all the time, aren't they? They don't miss the fish that head shoulders out. And, you know, yes, they have amazing results and they do brilliantly. Their bait presentation and delivery is fantastic and they're using good quality baits, but they're putting them in the right spot. And that is without doubt the most important thing. You know, I can think back to, you know, when I was a lot younger fishing, you'd have sort of two or three rods on two or three spots. And then one spot would start fishing, and then you'd put two rods on one spot, and it would always be the one side of that spot. Those guys that are, you know, the most consistent carp catchers, not only do they find the spot where the fish is, but they find the spot within the spot that is the best possible place to get a bite. And then they get, you know, once they found that, in someone like Adam, you know, they hit those spots meticulously every single cast. Nothing is, oh, that'll do. It's always, that's perfect. And the result is that they get the bites, you know, at the, you know, to show for it. So I would, you know, I just think, you know, you can get too hung up on bait. There are lots of brilliant, brilliant baits out there and lots of brilliant liquid additives, which obviously, if you're on the fish, could help you get maybe some more action. But the best bit of kit, I often say, when I was teaching at Sparsha, I'd often ask the students, how many of you have got a pair of Polaroids? And often you'd get this sort of blank expression. Well, I've got the very best Delkims you can buy, and I've got the very best reels and the very best rods. Did you know my rods are £350 each? I said, but you'd do a lot better just to spend £10 on a pair of cheap Polaroids, and then you'd know where to put your bait. So I always go back to that. People, you know, they get too hung up. I mean, obviously it helps to have the tools to get your rods, your bait into the right spot, but you know, looking is so important. And particularly now, we live in a world where you can sit and watch videos and listen to things on your phone all day long. If you're tinkering on your phone, you're not watching the pond. And you will be exactly the same, Jamie. I can think of loads of carp I've caught where I've seen something show, I've reeled in, moved, and then caught straight away. really big fish too, you know, proper big ones, because I was looking at the right time. And if you're looking at your phone or not looking out at the lake, you're going to miss that. So
I'm not quite so keen anymore, you know, older and wiser and time's a bit more precious, but I've gone through those hardcore days, and there were times where I was so heavily into the fishing that I stopped taking a radio with me for night time because I was missing fish boshing out at night just by having the you know, after it's gone dark, having the radio on in the bivvy. And you know, I even stopped, you know, this is pre-iPhones, you know, I stopped having a radio because I caught more fish when I didn't have a radio. And I'm somebody that likes background noise. You know, I have to go to sleep with radio on or a podcast or something. And I can only imagine, you know, if I was as keen as I was then, you know, with the stuff that's open to us, you know, I can watch my Virgin cable, you know, streamed on my iPhone that's hooked directly to my box. I can record the football tonight on the TV and watch it on the bank next week off my iPhone. It's crazy what's out there to us now. But it's not going to help you catch any more fish. And just as important as Polaroids is binoculars for me. The amount of times I've caught fish where you just wouldn't have seen them head and shoulder in, you know, 150 yards away, 200 yards away, but there's nothing going on in front of you, so you've got your binoculars out in another area thing. I wonder if the fish are over there, the sun's just going down over in that corner, and you're looking through your binoculars, see a fish not out, you move, and it maybe saves the session, you know. So it's, I completely agree. Observation is far more important than any rig or bait. And then I think even more important than rigs is getting them feeding. Like, if you can find a way that turns them on by, you know, whatever it is, little and often, or catapulting, sweet corning, or whatever it is, the rig then becomes less important because they want to feed. So they're going to
Definitely. Yeah, I caught a lot of my raspberry fish were just caught on size 6 hooks and nylon, 12 pound nylon, straight off the reel, chopped off, tie the rig, chuck it out. But chuck it out where the fish are feeding, and that was that.
That's a nice way to wrap it up, I think. It's been a fantastic interview, and probably the longest one to date.
I hope you don't lose a load of subscribers to the podcast off the back of it.
Quite the opposite. I know that I could sit here for another hour quite easily, plugging away with questions, but your time's precious. And
so we'll have to do a part two then.
I would love to, I would love to at some point, or maybe get a social on the bank and do a bankside one at some point. Maybe go on catch these biggins out of Oxley's or somewhere one day.
Yeah, that would be very good. Well, very, very good to talk to you, Jamie.
You too, Simon. Thank you very, very much for coming on the show. It's been an honour, a privilege, and a pleasure. I feel like I've learned tons. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Cheers.
Speak soon, pal. Bye-bye. Wow, yeah, he's fantastic. I still have way more questions than I've just asked him. So I cannot wait to get him back again, I think. And we'll get a load of listeners' questions, I think, next time we get him back, because there's so many little things I want to know. But should we move on to some of our listeners' questions?
Yeah, do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
I've got a question here from Jay Goodall. Ask us a question. Hiya, Mark and Jamie. I'm having some dramas catching on an old estate lake I am fishing at the moment. Just wondering if you had any advice for me. I've tried a variety of bottom baits and pop-ups on blowback rig with a size 6 corder microbarbed hooks. Any advice would be much appreciated. Doesn't really give us too much to go on that, does it?
No.
So,
I mean, it depends why he thinks he isn't catching. I mean, if he's on fish, I mean, there's two things, really. There's one, not fishing anywhere near where the fish are, or there's two, being on fish and not being able to get a bite. Two very different problems. The first one's obvious, especially if it's a small estate lake. I find small lakes can be tricky because the fish know their environment very well. So if the fish are kind of in front of you but just not relaxed enough to feed, or, you know, they're on edge or whatever, then you need to look at sort of concealing or creating a feeding situation that they can't ignore, you know, where you get them feeding confidently enough to not worry too much about the fact that you're fishing for them. You turn them on, essentially. Secondly, is watch them a lot more. You know, get up the trees if you can, and find the areas that they're actually feeding. With if it's an estate lake, presume there's trees and stuff around. Try and observe, and then there's, you know, if you're looking at the feeding methods, then it's kind of feeding stuff that they're not wary of. So you know, I'd be looking to get some hemp in there, with a few tigers in there, some corn, and trying to you know, get them feeding happily first before putting a bait in. I'd go for the pre-baiting option myself, I think, and just not fish and really try and get them feeding in a couple of areas.
Yeah, I'm going to make an assumption here. If he says old estate lake, and most estate lakes I've fished have been quite silty. Yeah. Look for them bubblers. Those bubblers can give the fish away.
Yeah, certainly. There's usually a lot of nuisance fish in estate lakes as well. Quite often there's a lot of tension stuff. I haven't fished many for years. In a lot of the Cheshire Lakes were estate lakes I fished when I was young. It's been quite a few years since I've fished them. But again, if they're silty, you know, you look for the dense bloodworm areas. Again, Simon Scott talked about some interesting stuff about the bloodworm. So you obviously just heard that. That might give you some clues as to you know, the sort of areas you might want to be looking at. There's not a lot of info there really, but I'd certainly be looking at pre-baiting and making sure you're on the fish. You know, if you're getting liners and stuff and you're pretty confident that you're on the carp, they're just not feeding you, then I'd just go really simple. You know, I'd be using like nylon hook link, you know, like a 10 pound sort of nylon hook link, just a knotless knot, and fishing, you know, like maize and fake corn, balanced, and you know, feeding hemp and corn, that sort of stuff. You're going to catch nuisance fish while you're doing it, but it might be a way rather than going with a straight boilie approach, and then just introduce boilie into your mix.
Yeah, I was looking at the question here. It says, tried a variety of bottom baits and pop-ups on a blowback rig. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the blowback rig. Nothing wrong with, you know, size 6 microbarbed hooks. Just make sure you check the sharpness of the point every time. But just think back to when you have been catching. What have you been confident with? Then stick with it. Don't get the wobbles.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've got another question here. Simon Harrett sent a question saying, if other members are smashing it on a certain bait on your syndicate and you've only had a few fish on various different baits, would you move on to the more common bait for that water, or would you stick to your guns and hope it comes good? I've tried a few different baits. I still feel like my results are a bait issue. If I moved to the going bait, at least I could rule that out as a reason why I'm so useless. Lol.
Ask us a question.
Interesting. I mean, I like to be different. I like to use something that I'm confident with. I have been on lakes where there's been, you know, like a kind of a baiting syndicate on there, and I've done my own thing and caught usually pretty well. I remember an estate lake actually I fished years ago in Gloucestershire. There was it's an interesting story actually. I don't know if Rod Cooper listens to this podcast or not. He's a long time carper, somebody who was somebody I looked up to when I was young. I used to go fishing with his lad on Horseshoe. In fact, his lad was a year or two older than me, so he used to drive us there before I was old enough to drive. But Rod used to fish all the circuit waters of the era in that area. And he was a very serious carper back in the day. I think he's got his own lake now. But they had this friend that worked in a ice cream factory. So he used to get the concentrated flavours, which is basically where the bait companies back in the day used to get their stuff from as well. The people that actually manufacture the flavours. And they had a bait going on this lake that I used to fish. Adelstrop Lake, it was called. Like tiny little estate lake, but like long and thin, like a canal that opened up into one bit. It was only a couple of acres, but it was like really long. And they had this bait called Boff and Trough, which were, it was kept very secret in the time. And this was when it was all a little bit more kind of secretive. And I found out that Boff was berries of the forest and Trough was tropical fruits of the forest. Which were basically concentrated ice cream flavours. But they had the fish going on these baits, and they believed that you couldn't really catch without it. But I hammered them on tiger nuts at the time. I caught just as much as anyone else. I was, you know, young keenie, and I did fish a lot there. When I left school, I had like 3-4 months of doing nothing, like a big long school holiday, which I literally just fished there. But I did catch doing my own stuff, and I caught at similar rates to the guys that had this bait going. But I have also heard of, you know, like a really effective baiting campaign done by, you know, 3 or 4 people that have all got together on one bait that nobody else could get a hold of, and they've hammered it. It got to the point where this bait was like natural bait, natural food in the lake, and you wouldn't catch on anything else. So I don't know what the bait is these guys are using. It's Sim Harrett. I don't know what the bait is. I mean, if it's something you could get hold of, you know, if you know what it is and you can get hold of it, then by all means buy it. Try it. Like you said, it rules out, it just takes some doubt out of your mind. If you see other people catching on that bait, it will take some doubt. But I mean, as a rule, I like to do something different. I mean, if this guys are putting so much in, like the example I've just said, where, you know, they're putting so much in all the main areas and it's just appears natural to the fish, then just get on, just use it. If your catch rates increase, then yes, it's the bait and not you. If you still are only catching as many as you're already catching, then I'd start looking at some of your tactics. And when it comes to looking at tactics, if you're losing confidence, and I've been in that situation many times where I don't think I'm catching what I should be catching, and I basically go simple when that happens. I go back to absolute basics. Don't try anything fancy. You know, I would, my go-to would be what I've just said here, like, you know, a 10-pound nylon hook link, knotless knotted, and a balanced or bottom bait that you're confident in, and start from there. Then start tweaking things, you know, as you go. What are your opinions on that one?
I've only really on a walk and fizzy, but I fished a lake that was, well, the lads who run it were sponsored by a certain bait company, and that was all that was going in, and I'm going to compete with anything on a one-off visit. So white pop-ups I caught.
Yeah,
I do love a white pop-up, but I think if you couldn't get hold of their bait, which that would be your plan A, plan B would be to fish singles. You know, if they're going bait is like the main course, give them a little bite for dessert, you know, something sweet, something that's going to attract them. I mean, it's singles, it's usually a kind of like a winter, early spring tactic, but done correctly, it can work any time of year, and not a lot of people are going to be doing it. Just stay mobile as well. As soon as you see a fish, bang a bait on it. You're not going to be tied down to a baited area.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I haven't thought of that. Yeah, give them some dessert. So yeah, if you've got questions, anything that's you're struggling with, then by all means get in touch. We'll take some autumn stroke winter questions as well this time of year, so get in touch with us on Twitter, Jamie Klosick, which is at Dustitute, or the Carpcast, which is
at the Carpcast,
at the Carpcast, yeah, or on our Facebook page or whatever. We're glad to answer questions, especially when the winter's coming and there's people less, there's a lot less people out fishing, a bit less news. Then we're quite happy to answer questions, content for the show. Talking of colder water and colder weather, we know carp aren't sheep, but some anglers are.
Carp are not sheep.
It's perch time.
It's drop shot time.
Get that drop shotted rod out, people. This is where all carp anglers become instant perch experts.
I've already started seeing the perch pictures. Mark Holmes posted a picture of a couple of pike and a big perch recently. He's got a new Facebook page. Mark Holmes, carp angler, I think it's called. But yeah, I've seen him posting some pictures up, and I might have a go this year. I'm sure we've got a drop shotting rod I bought at the back end of last year, and we've got a pretty good park lake in Blackpool that's full of all sorts of fish. So yeah, I'm going to have a little go this year, so I'm going to be a sheep.
Yeah, do it. I'm thinking also, I think I want to stay ahead of the pack. I think chub might be the new perch.
Chub was the other year. Chub, if you remember, like, people... The person responsible for most of the carp ain't sheep was Terry Hearn, and he was a chubber in the winter for many years. Then he moved on to perch fishing, and so did everybody else.
All right, then.
He's the trendsetter. Gudgeon. I like Gudgeon. Gudgeon was
great. Gudgeon's like, used to catch millions as kids. They're brilliant little things. You just wish they'd go to about 5 pounds, you'd never land them.
Yeah, I used to catch a lot of them on the canals around Macclesfield and stuff when I was young. And yeah, I did like the old gudgeon. But yeah, carp ain't sheep. Get your drop shotting rods out.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it. I've got a Worth a Look, actually. Another podcast, Worth a Look.
Worth a Look.
It was one that Joe Rogan put me onto, and the guy's been a guest on Joe Rogan a couple of times. But he's called Dan Carlin, and he's a modern historian. So what that basically means is history, which was incidentally my most boring subject at school. I hated history.
No future in it.
I just used to switch off. Was not interested in history when I was a kid. So maybe it's just because I'm getting old, or maybe it's because, like, stuff's kind of relevant that goes on in the world. And you can look at history for examples of how things are going to go now. But he's got a podcast series called Hardcore History. And he looks at history with kind of a modern point of view. Basically, history is an interpretation of, it's one person's interpretation of what went on, because you've kind of got sketchy recordings, you know. But remember, back in the sort of days we're talking about, not everyone could read and write. Quite often they couldn't. There was like one person in each community that could. So you're looking at, And of course, like, if you take, say, a war or something, like, say, the Romans versus somebody else, you're going to have, like, the people that were documenting it from the Roman side are going to give a very different account of a battle from a guy that was documenting it on the other side. You know, it's kind of like the Mark Holmes and Daryl Peck saga. Like, you're going to get one side of a story from one and another side of the story. Then you might get a couple of independents passing opinion. And some people who write history books and stuff, they're usually slanted to one side or the other. But then you get, like, a somebody like Dan Carlin, who kind of looks at all the angles and comes up with what I think is probably the most likely story. And he tells it in such a graphic way. I mean, it's called Hardcore History for a reason, because he pulls no punches. And he's looked at it. They're all free, these podcasts. I think you can listen to, like, his most recent ones free, and then you have to pay a small amount to get access to the back catalogue. My favourite one is called Wrath of the Khans, which is all about the Khans. If you haven't heard of them, it was Kublai was one of the later Khans. Who was the most famous Khan? Genghis Khan, sorry.
He's a bit mean.
Yeah. They reckon something like... what's the percentage? They reckon... it's quite a high percentage of every single person in the world has some of Genghis Khan's DNA. Such was his... they reckon he killed over 1 billion people in his lifetime. It's ridiculous. I'm not going to go into the detail, because it's really worth listening to this. Wrath of the Khans, I think it's like six parts, all like 2 to 3 hours each. It's the entire story of the Mongol Empire that just basically ravished the world and killed everybody in their path. They had a lot of weird customs as they did it, and usually ended up beheading all the men and raping all the women. It's pretty much what they did. But all the hardcore histories are really worth listening to. Just get on there, even if you haven't got time to listen to the Wrath of the Khans, get on there and download them all now before they vanish, because as he does new ones, the older ones disappear unless you want to pay for them. So his latest ones are all about World War One, moving on to World War Two. But just the way he tells the stories, the guy is amazing. And he's got the most logical point of view. He looks at all he cites all the different like tellings of a particular story, and then kind of comes to the conclusion, which I think is certainly, I relate to it anyway. It's probably the conclusion, if I was as clever as him, is what I would have come to. I think he ran for like office in America at one point as well, Dan Carlin. He has another podcast called Common Sense, which is not as, it's, I listen to it, it's not as relevant for if you live in the UK, because it's all about American politics, but a lot of their stuff affects us as well. You know, it's like when they're talking about like Iraq wars and stuff like that, it's all stuff that kind of affects us. But definitely get on his Hardcore History podcast.
I think I'm going to download them for my session this week. Now it's long nights.
Yeah, that Wrath of the Khans, download them all, because they are going to start disappearing, I think, as he does some new ones. But the way he, it's his podcasts are not like our podcast where we just kind of have a few subjects and wing it. I mean, you can see he releases them every few months, because the work that goes into them is unreal. It's like a book, if you know what I mean. It's like listening to an audio book. It's not like a podcast. They're fantastic. Anyway, Wrath of the Khans, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Get on him. that's pretty much do us. We're well over 2 hours again for this show. We are going to be every week.
Yeah, and next week will be the first part of my chat with Chris Ball. So if you like your carp fishing history, this is one not to be missed, because there's some brilliant stories in there. I was enthralled listening to him.
Yeah, and I cannot wait for that one. I've not heard it yet.
Is that a reminder to send it over?
Yeah, don't forget to send it to me so I can edit it. But once again, a thank you to our sponsors as well, dnabaits.com, www.dnabaits.com, and use the CARPCAST5 as a checkout code. Get a 5% discount off everything they do. Big thanks to Christoph at St. Armand Leisure. Which is www.saintamandleisure.com. Check out the YouTube video. The link's on our page and in the show notes underneath. That you'll see the lake is absolutely beautiful. We're going to go and check it out. We might even do an On the Bank live from there.
I think it would be rude not to.
Yeah, we're going to do it in the spring when the weather warms up a bit. You contact Lee on 07854 857 374, or talk to Chris himself 07428 183 018. For bookings, info and stuff, because they're doing a special offer. It's £850 for a week, sleeps up to 10 people. You get the house, you get the lake to yourself, and it's stuffed full of fish up to £47. So yep, check that out. And also giftsforanglers.co.uk. You definitely want to check those out for thousands and thousands of books, DVDs, clothing. Basically,
you should be leaving the PC open at that page, so when your wife finds it, she gets the ideas.
Yeah. Just leave leave little hints for your Christmas stocking. Like I say, thousands of books, clothing, carp course, game fishing, sea fishing, and you can get Crowe's new book on there, which we will be reviewing on a future show. And again, use the checkout code CARPCAST5, and you can get a discount off all purchases made at giftsforanglers.co.uk. That covers it for this week. But keep buying the knowledge DVDs if you want the knowledge from me, or if you just not had quite enough of my voice, then you can get another 5-6 hours of about 4.5 hours. I think the two DVDs are in total, maybe 5. You can listen to my dulcet tones even more. Just search the knowledge Jamie Klosick on eBay for that one.
How many copies has Ting Tong bought?
Probably bought a few. I've still one of my pals who I went to Romania with the other year, Romanian guy, I keep promising to send him some, and I've forgotten 3 times now, and I've just remembered again talking about the knowledge. So I shall send you some kits, I promise. I will. I'll do it in the next batch I send out. So that's it from us. We'll see you next Friday.
Yeah, next week.
Yeah, cool. See you later.